Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, 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 everybody, to Morris Talk Live 100. I'm your host, the Hawk, Amana Elbey. And tonight, we're dealing with Phoenicians, Moors, Law, and our ancient story in the Americas. Now, before we get started, I want to ask you a few questions. And I want you to think about this. And I know you done heard this here before, but we're going to ask it one more time. You went to daycare. You went to kindergarten. You went to first grade, second grade, third grade, fourth grade, fifth grade, sixth grade, junior high, senior high. And then you got out, you went to college, yeah, universities, all of these places. And all of this education that you are supposed to have. Now, my question to you is, when was it that you were taught about your language, about your customs, about your ancient story and your ancient sciences and your contribution to the world? When were you taught that? When were you taught that? Now, the reason I'm asking this question is because I went through all of these grades and not one time had to tell me I'm going to teach you about your original language that you had or your original customs. I'm going to teach you about who you are and your ancient story. I'm not going to use the word indigenous. I was never told that. No one said I'm going to tell you who you are and who is absolutely indigenous to this land that you're standing on. What we're going to do is we're going to teach you Spanish. We're going to teach you French. We're going to teach you German language. We're going to teach you everything except anything that applies to you. We're not going to teach you about the art of money. We're not going to teach you the art of having a mate, a mating. We're not going to teach you the art of war. And we are certainly not going to teach you what you are supposed to have done about the people who murdered your own people on your own land. Well, tonight we're going to get down in here. We're going to open up a few things, and hopefully you'll be able to get somewhere and learn a few things. And I'm going to my first commercial break, and y'all hold on a minute. We'll be right back. Okay, everybody. October the 26th, right here in Duval County, Jacksonville, Florida, the Black Vegan Fest will take place. Live bands, live entertainment, professional chefs will teach you how to cook healthy. If you are a vendor, go to www.urbangeoponics.org and sign up. Bring your fishing gear with you if you're a fisherman. We got the river right in the back of the property. We'll teach you how to grow your own food. Teach your children how to do the same thing. You'll learn how to prepare meals healthy. There'll be fun and games for the whole family. October the 26th, the Black Vegan Fest, right here in Jacksonville, Florida. Don't miss it. Make sure you got some cash with you, because vendors will be on hand and they'll be selling their wares. October the 26th, the Black Vegan Fest, right here, Jacksonville, Florida. Don't miss it. Be here.
All right, we're back. Now,
Tonight we'll be dealing with the following questions, but that's going to be on the back burner. But here we go. Who were the Phoenicians? How do we navigate through American law? How far back does our ancient story go? Who are the oldest peoples in the lands of the Americas? What was the ancient Songhai Empire? What was that? Who were the blacks in ancient China? What was that? What does man know thyself mean? What does that mean? We're going to be dealing with that this evening, but before we get down into all of that, I want to ask a few questions, okay? And you can answer these questions. The phone lines are open. The number to dial in is 563-999-3443. 563-999-3443. One day, when I was on my job, there was a sister sitting outside. And I went outside and I was talking to her. And here comes a Caucasian engineer that come out and he sit down over from us, but among us. And I'm talking to her about her identity, her story, and what we need to do, actually take action about the people who were the murderers of our ancestors. He listened, he listened, he listened. Finally, he couldn't take it no more. He jumped up and got in our right ear. I'm in the left ear. He said, I don't care what you do. You believe in Jesus. You always believe in Jesus. Always don't never stop believing in God. I'm in that left ear. I said, what you do is you get rid of that crap and believe in yourself. Then you are able to see who it was that murdered your people, and then you will blow their brains out. Believing, always believe in God, always believe in Jesus, no matter what. Nobody tell you, you always believe in Jesus. And I'm in the left ear. I said, look, if you get rid of that crap, take his Bible and throw it away. He ain't got no history. Every way he ever went on earth, he killed somebody. He murdered your people. It was, all you got to do is get rid of it, and then you will know who to kill and what to do. This went on for a good solid 10 minutes. Nonstop. Doing everything he could to force something in her mind to believe in something outside of herself. And I'm steady telling her, I can provide you with proof so you can actually see who it was. Give him his religion back. Give him his Bible back. You'll know who it was that done what they did, and then you will know what to do about what they did and who to do it to. All right, hold on a minute. We'll be right back.
Let me make sure I got this right. You have a mortgage. You were told the bank would give you a loan for your home. But when you got to the bank, they didn't give you anything or sign anything. But presto changeo, you have a new mortgage. Then you find out your mortgage has been sold to another company you don't know and don't have any contract with. It seems to me something is wrong. When you walked out the bank, you had some papers in your hand, but no check. Let's get to the bottom, down to the bottom of this kind of stuff. Go to TahakaDebtElimination.org. That's TahakaDebtElimination.org. Let's bring the fraud to a close. How about that? This kind of stuff is going on all over the United States, but most people don't even understand what to do about it. TahakaDebtElimination.org.
All right, we're back. Now, I don't want you to get me wrong. The only thing that I'm trying to tell you is there is a difference between believing in something and knowing something for a psych that you can prove. When you believe in something, I have questions. What is it that you believe in? Well, I believe in God. Well, have you ever seen him? Well, I believe in Jesus. When the last time you've been to his house and what side of town he live on? Well, I think we need to believe in God. Who and what in the hell is that? Where you ever seen him at? You got to believe in something. How about believing in you? How about that? How about believing in you, your skills, your knowledge, your techniques, your abilities, your strength, your power, your customs, your culture, your ancient story? How about that? Why don't you do that? What's wrong with you doing that? What is it that's stopping you from doing that? If you see, I look at it this way. If you was a man that you got a lawnmower, you cut yards. And I asked you, I said, well, do you know how to cut yards? Yes, I do. Do you think in your mind that it is Jesus a God that's helping you cut these yards? Or do you believe in your ability to cut these yards? Did you wake up in the morning on your own volition, with your own mind, your own body, your own DNA, your own within you? Or do you believe that there was some unimaginary force from somewhere else that you ain't never seen and you don't know nothing about that woke you up? Which way you going? See, it's one thing if I ask you, do you know how to cut yards? You say, well, no, I don't know nothing about it. Man, I have never really did it in before. No. Do you believe that you can do it?
Well, I think, you know, I
but you don't know for a fact how to do it. Well, no, not for a fact how to do it. Okay. That means that you're ignorant. That's just simply something that you don't know. But if I tell you, look, what if I show you how to do it? So you will know how to do it for a fact. At this point, I need to know where anything that you believe in outside of yourself come in. And if you tell me, well, I don't want you to show me how to do it, I'm willing to just try to do it and mess it up if I have to or whatever, and then some kind of way, sooner or later, I get bad, better. But anyway, if you do that, that means that you are stupid. Ignorance is one thing, but stupidity is something else. When you know for a fact that you don't know, and at the same time, you are not willing to know. If you don't know, you're ignorant. And at the same time, there's somebody to show you the truth, show you the light, and you still don't want to know, that means that you are stupid. That's what that means. All right, I just wanted to go over that part right now. Okay, I'm trying to get everything lined up because I've been going over this stuff here for a long, 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 long time. Now, you have an opportunity to have a nationality. I asked you, what's your nationality, man? I'm African American. That's not a nationality. I'm Negro. I'm colored. I'm black. That's not a nationality. Well, man, I'm not bumping. You know, I'm just as I am. Would you like to know? No, man, I ain't with that, man. I don't need to know none of that right there. That means what? That means you're stupid. Anyway, let's go on to the next thing. Because if I ask her, Chinese guy. I said, what's your nationality? He said, I'm Chinese. If I ask a Korean guy, I said, what's your nationality? Well, I'm Korean. If I ask a Japanese, what's your nationality? I'm Japanese. But when I get to people who look like me, what's your nationality? Man, I don't need to know all that. I'm just me. Okay. I insist on being stupid. I insist. Now, here's something else. In any given year, how much book reading have you done? Have you taken any time out of your year to read something? If one number of paragraph in the book, have you done that? Or have you went through the whole year not reading nothing because you believe that you don't need it? And at the end of the year, you're in the same position that you was in previous years, not recognizing that something is wrong. You see, it doesn't matter what you believe in, but when you know the truth, when you know better, when you learn better, then you can do better. I done ran into all kind of stuff. We had we was building a bridge right down here in Jacksonville, Florida, off of Basin Myrtle. The big general manager, he come up out of Alabama, big old white boy. He come out there. We done build these here columns. We got four sleeves wrapped around these columns, and they together weigh a ton. We got a crane on the side over there. And he gonna tell y'all, hold on a minute. Let me show you how to do this here. Now, he ain't been on the job site since we started working. We've been out there for 4 months. He trying to give the crane operator signals to slide the steel columns off the concrete that done dried. But he giving the crane operator the wrong signals. He done made several attempts, ain't nothing happening. So he turned to me and the guy standing there with me, I want y'all to go up there and take all the bolts loose on that column. Take every bolt, take them completely loose. Take it all loose. Then he walks off. I said, it's 99 degrees in the shade out here. I ain't doing that because we don't need to do that. I said, we're going to loosen up a few bolts, brother, and I'll tell you when to stop. So we did. I went over there and looked at the crane operator. I said, hey, man, watch this. I directed the crane operator to bring the boom over the sleeve. Put it over a little bit and back up a little bit and then spin it and drag it up. Snatch the steel off the sleeve. The white man, he watching me. He got mad. I told you to do what the hell I said. I didn't tell you to do. I said, I ain't doing a damn thing. You scaring these motherfuckers. Excuse me. But I don't want y'all to think I'm. But anyway, I said, okay, man. It's off. It's over and done. But anyway, let's get down up in here with what else we talking about here. Because I want to get some things right. Because people call me from all over the world are talking about how to do this, that, and the other, a secure party and creditor and legal and illegal and law and all of that. Let me ask you a question. I live in Florida. You may live in Alabama, Mississippi, Detroit, Texas, Arizona, New York, South Carolina, Mississippi, Tennessee, California, no matter where you live. However, what does the Constitution of your state say about law? Have you taken the time to study the Constitution of the state in which you reside? Have you done any of that? it may be a good idea if you do some of that. That may be a good idea. Well, we have legal, we have illegal, we have paralegals, we have statutes and ordinances that we have. Me personally, I just like the law. However, I'm not above in getting down in that Constitution and your statutes and ordinances to make sure you follow them to the letter, and you will always discover they ain't. And that's where you hang them. You can hang them high right there. Are you a citizen of your state? Now, I know you are more. I know you are more. But what do you have in regards to state citizenship that you can deal with? What do you have about that? Now, you already know that the United States of America filed Chapter 11 bankruptcy in April of 1933. they're still in the same bankruptcy. And they ain't got no money because gold is money and everything else is credit. Remember that. Gold is money and everything else is credit. Don't forget that. And so therefore and thus, we're in this position where we're going to have to do something. We can't be scared to do it. Give him his religion back. The foods he eat, give it back to him. The clothes he wear, give it back to him. His beliefs and lies, give it back to him. Replace it with what you know for a fact in your customs, your culture, and what you are supposed to be doing on your land in this country. But don't throw out something that you can use. Examine everything. Turn over every rock. Okay? Now I'm going down the list here. Because we're going to get down into this law thing here today. Does your home give you a profit? Does your home pay for itself? Does your automobile pay for itself? Does people around you benefit from association with you? And now I got to get down on this right here because you got to understand now we have people who are they are operating on a low vibrational frequencies, very low vibrational frequencies. So when you come along and you are resonating at a high vibrational frequency and they become agitated and hateful towards you, it is because you are irritating their demons. Case in point. I went to the store the other day. There was an older gentleman. He looked like he got to be in his late 70s. But he's got a cell phone attached to his ear with rock and roll music that could be heard almost at the end of the walkway before you even got up there. And I'm looking at this old brother. And I'm like, well, golly, and he got it up against his head, up against his face, but you can hear this kind of music. So I put my little bike up. I ride my bike to the store. Go in the store, get what I got to get. Then went in there 15 minutes. I come back out. He's standing there, but now he done removed the phone from his ear. I said, how you doing, brother? He said, man, don't say nothing to me. Don't be speaking to me, man. And turn around and ran in the store. Don't talk to me, man. Don't say that. I said, oh, my goodness. Boy, I really irritated them demons real bad. So you run into that out there. But nevertheless, we'll be back because I got more questions. Y'all hold on. We're going to another commercial break. Hold on.
Let me make sure I got this one right also. Someone tells you that you must pay them money about your children in the form of child support. They also say they would suspend your driver's license. And they said they would garnish your wages. Who were they talking to? A debtor? Or did they make the mistake and say it to a creditor? When you got married, they say they was a part of that also. Request my free report at thehawkerdebtelimination.org. That's thehawkerdebtelimination.org. Let's have some fun. Fill out the contact us form for my free report, and I'll rush it straight to your email box. What about this banking stuff? What's going on in the United States? I tell you what, request my free report at thehawkerdebtelimination.org. Peace.
All right, we're back. Now, you remember I told you on more than one occasion, and I don't recommend banks. I always recommend your credit union. That's for the people. Okay. Now, when you deposit $100 into your bank account, what do you think happens? Well, the bank takes a certain documentation, fill it out, because they got your information, they got your social, all of that, and give it to the Treasury Department, and the Treasury Department send them money on your behalf. And you got your money in there, you just getting interest. That explains a lot of things. And not only that, I told you about trust. You look at my old videos, it's right there. Trust, irrevocable common law trust. A common law trust, I already done that. How to put that in there, all of that has already been given to you. But what we're going to do, we're going to take and go down here and deal with some stuff involving banking. We're going to deal with this law first. Y'all hold on.
Everybody knows when you want to buy a house, you have to be able to show income. You have to show that you can afford the mortgage payments on the house that you want to buy. But if you're buying an investment property, there's a way around this. You can do something called a DSCR loan. Now, this loan allows you to qualify for the home without showing any income. Actually, you don't have to have any income at all and still can qualify for the loan. Now, as long as this property cash flows and the rental income is equal to or more than the mortgage payments, you're good to go. This is how real estate investors buy multiple properties over and over again without showing any income. All you need to worry about is your down payment, and you can leverage your credit to get that capital. So now you're 0% out of pocket. This is just one of the strategies that we use in My Investors Academy.
This is how you make your child a trust fund baby. First, designate your child as the beneficiary of the trust. Next, any life insurance policies that you have, be sure to designate the trust as the beneficiary listed with the life insurance company. That way, when you pass away, the trust receives the funds from the life insurance death benefit. This is helpful because minor children cannot receive death benefits directly. It would go through probate court. For any real estate that you own, be sure to transfer the ownership into the trust so that your child can receive it tax-free. For any cash or other assets that you may own, be sure that it is transferred into the trust so that you can choose the frequency of the payment from the trust to your child and at what age. After completing this process, your child would then be a trust fund baby.
Here are five legal contracts that are absolutely necessary for your business. Number one, an operating agreement. Operating agreement is your company's rule book. Without it, the state will decide for you. And baby, you do not want that. Number two, a non-disclosure confidentiality agreement. This document is going to protect sensitive information that you are sharing with employees, contractors, partners, potential investors. Number three, independent contractor agreement. If you are hiring people to work for your business on a contract basis, this needs to be well defined, because if the IRS determines that you're treating them as a contractor when they should be an employee, you're going to find yourself in a lot of trouble. Number four, I'm all for collaboration over competition, but when you are collaborating with another business, it needs to be very clear how profit and losses are split, who owns the intellectual property, definitely confidentiality. What are some ways a collaboration can be terminated if things are not working out the way you thought? Number five, a copyright transfer agreement. Anyone who had a logo created by a graphic designer or a photo taken by a photographer or a podcast recorded, baby, that content does not belong to you. It belongs to the person who took it, recorded it, or created it. They own all the intellectual property unless they assign it over to you. But don't worry, you can get these contracts for up to 70% off. Comment the word contracts and I'll send you the link.
This is how you properly structure an IUL within a trust. In the case of a 35-year-old woman who wants to save $500 monthly or $6,000 annually within a trust-owned index universal life insurance policy, included within the $500 monthly savings, the cost of whole life insurance is only $59.27, which is the only requirement in order to keep the policy active. This buys an initial death benefit of $158,43,000. The rest goes into a cash value account to grow at 7.08% compounded interest. When she's ready to purchase a home, a car, or an income-producing asset, she has the privilege to take a tax-free loan against the cash value without interrupting the compounding growth. Because the loan does not come from the cash value account, it is lent to her by the insurance company from their general fund, as if it were a line of credit utilizing the cash value as a collateral, which is not mandatory to pay back. After 20 years of contribution, she now has over $200,000 in her cash value account. And with no further contributions 10 years after that, her account has compounded and grew to a nest egg of over $400,000. Now, this includes a death benefit that totals in over $500,000. And when she passes away, the trust is the beneficiary and receives the money in a trust-owned bank account with instructions for her loved ones. Now, if you want more information about how to properly structure an IUL within a trust, drop key phrase IUL in the comment section.
All right. Now, those little pieces of nuggets there, I decided I'll put them together and bring it out and show it to you. Now, usually what we do over here at targetdataelimination.org, once they get our packages and stuff, we walk you through this stuff one step at a time. We get you with your foundation. When you call, we answer the phone. First of all, let's get that part right. We're available to talk to you, to guide you and show you from 9:30 a.m. until 6:45 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 7 days a week. We do not do any European holidays. We don't follow any European customs. We only follow the teachings of our own people, the people who look like us on our own land, which you call America. We're not confused about that. And then we we can prove what we're talking about. Now, I'm going to take a little quick break and I'll be back. Okay. So y'all hold on a minute. We'll be right back and we will continue. And we're going to deal with a little bit of Africa, the little Songhai Empire and stuff. We're going to deal with that. We're going to get down in our ancient story and all of that. But right now, I want to concentrate on this here law. So y'all hold on a minute. We'll be right back. Hold on. We'll be right back. back. Now, I want to introduce you to something, and we've already put this information out before. We're going to bring it back up again so you can take another look at it. Okay? We're going to start with one thing, and then we're going straight into the next thing. Here we go. Y'all hold on.
I'm asking the question.
Are you saying, well, you answer one of my questions, I'll answer one of yours. Do you believe that corporations are people?
I am not going to weigh in on that. We're going to have a long campaign here, but I want to
really
know what
corporations
you think about
are. Corporations are people. You won't weigh in on whether some people are people? That seems kind of racist, George.
Uh-huh. I am going to move on because
really?
One of your top supporters.
I bet you will.
We could raise taxes on people. That's not the way. That, corporations are people, my friend. We can raise taxes on. Of course they are. Everything corporations earn ultimately goes to people. So, where do you think it goes?
It goes in their pocket.
Whose pocket? Whose pocket? People's pocket. Okay, human beings, my friend.
And everybody knows that, but that kind of spoils the game that they've been playing on our 71.
You see the point?
When they incorporated, turned the Republic into a corporation in order to put the Moors later, as they did earlier, solidify the 14th Amendment artificial person in the state of Delaware as Christian property. This is why such persons are called Negroes, Black, and Coloreds, and whatever they call themselves this week, can't vote with them names that don't belong to them, except that the overseer, or what you call the CEO, through the Senate, agrees that their cattle can vote as three-fifths persons because they have no name and nationality. When you understand these, the history from a law perspective, your view will change from it just being some historical flaw or some little dirty trick that the Europeans do. You would need to understand its political ramifications. Because you transact business in another man's name, don't talk about estates and don't talk about property because you don't even own your own body. And this is where, under the Christian Black Codes, where they set up where the marriage license is registered in the Department of Commerce, then registered in the Department of Orphans, and this is where your children, even before they're born, become wards of the state, which is a legal term for night slave. And see, nobody's offended because they know that most of our people don't read law, and so they just hear the word and it's interesting, you know. And then the scholars ain't going to tell them because they're playing this black game. Do you understand? When they know these people aren't black.
A serious case can be made for the need for a constitutional amendment which says simply and straightforwardly, a corporation is not a person. Free speech is a massive issue. It's an absolute massive issue. The corporate personhood is much bigger than that. And that's why when Bernie said, I want a constitutional amendment that says corporations are not people, I was so pleased to hear that because I know there are some people running around saying, well, we just need to put some limits on the constitutional free speech of corporations. No, I'm sorry. We need to strip corporations of the power that they have in this country.
And I'm proud to say that Monday night at our town meeting, we voted to end corporations' constitutional rights and corporate personhood in our community.
Let us say this. If you ask the average child in elementary school today, and particularly even a few generations back, how did your family become known as Smith? They will tell you. Either, oh, that's my grandma's name on my grandma's side or my grandpa's name. And you ask them, well, where did they get it from? Oh, they got that from the slave master, which means they're not ignorant, which means they knew the truth. They did nothing to correct it, did they? That's a contract. It's called acquiescence. So it automatically gives the corporate state jurisdiction, which the modern word used for the slave is called ward, W-A-R-D, ward of the state. And state, not the land, state the corporation. Then you have boards of governors that govern all the states in the Commonwealth. Their responsibility is to protect the stock, S-T-O-C-K, of the citizens. Negroes, blacks, and coloreds are stocks, starting with the birth certificate and any other contract you make with them.
If you don't understand that, get that together real quick.
So go to the word person. Here we are. Person.
under law, it is an entity that is recognized as an individual that has rights in its existence, capable of suing and being sued, to enter into contracts, to appear in court, as well as other powers that are generally available to any recognized entity under law. At times, a person may also refer to a corporation. So we're going to use this chart to break down the word person in law. Okay, person is of two kinds, artificial person and natural person. Artificial person, persons created and devised by human laws for the purposes of society and government as distinguished from natural persons. Corporations are examples of artificial persons. On to the word natural person. Natural person, a living, breathing human being, as opposed to a legal entity such as a corporation. Different rules and protections apply to natural persons and corporations, such as the Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination, which applies only to natural persons.
If you don't understand that, get that together real quick.
We're speaking today with Eric Ortz, a professor of legal studies and business ethics at Wharton, about his new book released in September here, titled Business Persons, A Legal Theory of the Firm. Thanks for joining us today, Eric.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm happy to be here.
The book covers a lot of ground, but I think today I'd like to focus on a couple of specific ideas in the book that were very interesting. One has to do with executive compensation, and the second has to do with the Citizens United Supreme Court case. So based on the Citizens United decision, corporations are people too, right? Or are they?
Well, that's one of the main questions that I try to answer in the book, or at least elucidate. So the title of the book is called Business Persons. And what I mainly argue in much of the book is that corporations are persons, but that doesn't mean that they're people, and therefore, as the majority of the Supreme Court said, they have all of the rights, apparently, that people do.
Persons, not people.
Yeah, so now it's interesting because actually people are persons in legal terms as well, and so we don't treat all people equally either. So infants are treated differently than adults. Aliens are treated differently than citizens. Slavery was a big issue for many years until rights were accorded to every person without any discrimination. So the idea of legal persons is quite a deep and difficult idea in the law in general. And what I try to talk about in the book is how businesses are persons, and really it wouldn't make any sense to think of them not as persons, or it would cause a radical revolution in how we act every day.
Negroes, blacks, and coloreds are stocks, starting with the birth certificate and any other contract you make with them.
If you don't understand that, get that together real quick.
And it says the word Negro means a black man. The term Negro means necessarily a person of color. But not every person of color is Negro. Case law following it. Now go to the word colored person, or the word colored, in the Black's Law Dictionary, 4th edition. And it states, it has also been held that there is no legal technical signification to the phrase colored person, which the courts are bound judicially to know. Why? Because it's an artificial person. An artificial person is persons created and devised by human laws for the purpose of society and government as distinguished from natural persons. Corporations are examples of artificial persons.
Do you understand it? Then you understand why they incorporated you as a being. And it doesn't make corporation itself bad. It means understand what corporation is, and understand when someone creates a corporation and tries to pull you into that jurisdiction, whether or not you belong there or if you agreed to it, i.e. whether you challenge that jurisdiction that they created. And what they did, they created Negro, black, and colored, a set of Christian black codes from the church that set up a system in governance that dealt with the movement of these living beings, which is called chattel property, in a bureaucratic manner under wardship status, wards of the state, as stock, being held by the European families with these Ajaxes who bear their name, which indicates them as property. And all certification certificates, etc., relative to those matters, are liens are filed against it by the Europeans, and therefore they can smile on your face and you never know they own you. And then when you get bad treatment, they give you an argument, and that argument is called racism, prejudice, and stuff, and you argue in that, and they really stole your birthright.
We're going to use the word blackamoor in the same chart that we use to break down the word person legally. So when we're dealing with the artificial person, and black person is on the artificial person side of the word blackamoor, and moor or moorish is on the natural person side of the chart. So dealing with the black person side of the word blackamoor, when we go to Black's Law Dictionary, 4th edition, we have the word Negro. And it says the word Negro means a black man. The term Negro means necessarily a person of color. But not every person of color is Negro. Case law following it. Now go to the word colored person, or the word colored, in the Black's Law Dictionary, 4th edition. And it states, it has also been held that there is no legal technical signification to the phrase colored person, which the courts are bound judicially to know. Why? Because it's an artificial person. An artificial person is persons created and devised by human laws for the purpose of society and government as distinguished from natural persons. Corporations are examples of artificial persons. So, Moorish person. Go to OnlineEtymologyDictionary.com, and you're going to go to Moorish. Moorish means by definition of or pertaining to Moors. Okay? And when you go to the definition of Moor, go to the highlighted section you see on the screen. It says, being a dark people in relation to Europeans. Now, that's describing a natural person. So Moorish person in this chart, natural person, a living, breathing human being, as opposed to a legal entity such as a corporation. Different rules and protections apply to natural persons and corporations, such as the Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination, which applies only to natural persons.
Listen to an officer's words when a woman says she was afraid to move her hands.
Remember, we only kill black people. Yeah, we only kill black people, right?
That's exclusive dash cam video. New at 6, the officer is trying to explain himself.
Live, local, late breaking. This is Channel 2 Action News at 6 p.m. Coverage you can count on.
Good evening, I'm Justin Farm.
I'm Javita Moore. Only Channel 2 Action News got dash cam video of a DUI. Stop now. We want you to listen because it's the officer's words, not his actions here, that have him under an internal investigation. Channel 2's investigative reporter, Mark Winnie, is live at Cobb County Police Headquarters. And Mark, the officer's attorney says he was only trying to get that woman to comply.
Yeah, in fact, we were led to believe the officer was eager, in fact, to tell his side to go on camera, but his attorney intervened. We do, however, have a detailed statement from that attorney, but first the video.
Use your phone. It's in your lap right there.
I just don't want to put my hands down. I'm really sorry. I'm
just really drunk.
No. I've just been way too many videos of problems.
But you're not black. Remember, we only kill black people. Yeah, we only kill black people, right? All the videos you've seen, have you seen black people get killed? Yeah.
Register says the speaker is Lieutenant Greg Abbott and indicated he has been assigned to administrative duties pending the outcome of the investigation. Register says the recording is part of a DUI stop and a female passenger indicates she was hesitant to put her hands down to pick up a cell phone because she didn't want to get shot. Lawyer Suri Chata Jimenez says he represented the driver in the DUI case.
It makes you cringe when you hear it.
Chata Jimenez says he believes the officer was being sarcastic after the passenger gave him some lip, but the fear minorities have when stopped is real.
But it's still unacceptable.
The chief says Abbott has been a heretofore good officer and he's not aware of any racial bias complaints.
Okay, we're back. Before we go on to the next plug, at this point, the last part on there, I have a question for you. Your beloved sister, your beloved brother, your mother is out there on the streets, and something like that happens to her. In my personal opinion, and this is just me, man, I ain't telling you to do nothing like that, but the only thing that I want to know is who was the man that stopped her and where he at. That's it. I ain't calling this apartment downtown. I have other ways to find it out. That's all I want to know, and I'll do the rest. But anyway, let's go on to something that I brought out a long, long time ago. It's been a long time since I dealt with this, but I want to bring it back out again. It's only going to last a few minutes. Then we'll get on back down into the broadcast because we're going to have to deal with our ancient story in the Americas and the Phoenicians and all that. But right now we're dealing with law. Yo, hold
watch
on
this video before it's removed from the internet.
I taught him syntax, the math interface on grammar, and he taught me all the secrets of the procedures of judges. But a lot of the things he taught me, he was in error of, because two-thirds of all the words were missing from the procedures by which he wanted to formulate answers. Now, believe it or not, we are all actors in a play that have been already written. All of you believe that you have a certain amount of choice to make in life. But the fact is, and I will do this later this afternoon when we get into some history programs, that we are on timetables that run on 7-year international, on domestic bankruptcies and 70-year international bankruptcies. These bankruptcies control the planet for the last 6,500 years in all countries. All countries worldwide are controlled by the post office, not the courts, not the judges, not the kings and queens, but the postmasters of the world run the entire planet, have for 6,700 years, going all the way back to Pharaoh, henceforth the Mason. Now, a lot of you were in this room today. A room is a closed area, so therefore it's a court. I'm going to show you a dollar bill here, which you're all familiar with. And on the back of the dollar bill, you have the eagle, right? Notice the eagle's wings are turned up. If you notice, the eagle's wings here are turned down. That's because it's a phoenix. This is Vatican rule, banking. And the flag here has a yellow fringe on it. And the yellow fringe flag has a... changes the dimension of the flag. This is a maritime braid for commerce. The fringe changes the description of the flag. It's under Army Regulations 840-10, Chapter 2-6. Allows for fringe to be put on military flags for parades. But anything you put on top of the flag cancels the contract of what a flag is. So even though you think you're looking at a United States flag, United, UN means no, and ITE is citizen. A no citizens condition of state flag controlled by Vatican banking. You're all under commerce. Well, who's the Vatican? They're postmasters. They work with Bern, Switzerland through the Universal Postal Union. On the 29th of September 2009, I did a seminar in Auckland, New Zealand. In that seminar, there were 90 Auckland tribal chiefs of the 1,200 tribal chiefs that live in New Zealand. I then made a statement that the post office, since 1800, has never had a correct parse, syntax, grammar, law, rule, regulation, or code in any language with any people on planet Earth. As a result of that, 72 hours later, 3 days, the United States Postal Service, which since 2000 has had a quantumized postal treaty with myself and Russell Gould, my business partner, two of us make corporate. On the 27th of August, 1999, I sued the United States of America for the flag of the United States. I filed a new quantumized mathematical patent on the description of the flag of the United States, 1 to 1.9. And it used the correct grammar called parse syntax grammar. As a result of that, on August 12, 1999, I owned the patent to the flag of the United States of America. And on August 13th, All flags had yellow fringe put on it because it had to change the dimension of the flag. Now, I don't know if you remember in 1968 when the astronaut, for those of you that are old enough, and I don't think there's a whole lot of you here that are old enough, the astronaut stepped off his spacecraft into his footprints on the moon, turned around, looked at Earth, and says, oh, look, Earth is a vessel in a sea of space. And that, with that one single sentence, Earth is a vessel in a sea of space, that's maritime. The entire...
Okay. We back, y'all. All right, now you heard what he said about the post office. You heard that. We'll be right back, y'all. Hold on a minute.
If it is against the law for the bank to loan out depositors' money to you, how could the bank give you a loan? And if that's the case, how are they able to keep their doors open? And in some cities, they have the biggest buildings in town. What happens to the person who deposits money in the bank? What do they receive outside of nickels and dimes in the form of what's called interest? How can you get paid? Go to TahakaDebtElimination.org. That's TahakaDebtElimination.org. Fill out the contact us form and I'll rush you my free report. Let's get down to the bottom of this situation. Let me show you how what's going on and how to deal with it. Okay? TahakaDebtElimination.org. Peace, y'all.
All right, we're back. Now, what I want to do at this point now, we're still dealing with this law stuff, but we got plenty of time. Here's a man, and I've already put this out in the past, but we're going to do it one more time to show you how, one more time, how the United States of America do stuff. Now, I want you to listen very, very carefully one more time. Just one more time.
I am a black Egyptian. My father is much darker than I am. My mother is lighter than I am. In Egypt, people are identified by the religion first, not the race. So in Egypt, if you are Christian, you are a minority person. But if you're black, you're not a minority person. You are a part of the mainstream society. And I came from this background. And in Egypt, you identify as Arab and as Muslim. And in this country, when I first came, I identified myself as Arab American and Muslim first. And gradually, I became to identify myself as black. I came to the U.S. in 1978. And I became U.S. citizen in 1985. When I became a U.S. resident, I was told by the Immigration and Naturalization that I am white. And I told them that I am black, and they said, no, in this country, you are white. All Arabs in this country, all Arab immigrants are white. I didn't pay much attention in the beginning to this because in the Arab world, we identify with our ethnicity first as Arabs and then with the race second as black or white or whatever. But in this country, you identify with your racial group first and then with your ethnicity second. Gradually, I became black first and Arab second. And I rejected my white classification publicly for the first time in 1987, in February, as a panelist in a function sponsored by the Association of the Study of Black Life and History in Detroit. I said that I belong to two minority groups. I am Arab American and Black American, and I'm racially black and ethnically Egyptian. I was harassed by my employer right after that. I work for a white school district. The superintendent is white. All the associate superintendents are white, even though that we provide services to 30% black population. But the organization is white and the approach is very white. The attitude towards me changed completely after I went out publicly and rejected my white classification. One coworker came to me and told me right after the function that he met with the superintendent, and if I don't keep my mouth shut, my educational career is over. He said, you have nothing to do with these people. You have a history and a culture. These people came from the jungle. You have nothing to do with them. These people lie and steal. When I see one of them in my neighborhood, I call the police. And I was told by the director of general education, who is retired now, in 88, I was told by him that I get people angry when I say that I'm black Egyptian. If I just say that I'm Egyptian, I would get along. I have to add that I was denied promotion twice because I chose black classification. This is part of my two lawsuits against my employer, which are currently pending. Two lawsuits.
Now, just for the education of our viewership, why don't you share with us a breakdown of Egypt as it is today, insofar as blacks or combinations thereof of European descent and what have you?
We don't have Egyptians of European descent in Egypt. We have a population which is basically a mixture of ancient Egyptian blacks who intermarried with Arabs right after the Arab conquest. The ancient Egyptian population was brown and black before the Arab conquest. But before the Arab conquest came the Greeks. The ancient Egyptian population was in Egypt for thousands of years. The ancient Egyptian population was brown and black. And the Greeks came in 300 BC and they started to intermarry with the local population. And then the Romans came and ruled from 70 BC until they were conquered by the Arabs and kicked out by the Arabs in the 7th century. And these people intermarried with the Egyptian Copts. And they made the pigmentation of the Egyptians, the Copts, much lighter because of this intermarriage with Europeans.
Now, you're an educator, okay? Now, how do you deal with situations when you practice your profession insofar as dealing with the mythology or the misconceptions about Egypt being a white civilization? How do you deal with that?
This is a big problem because Egypt, the ancient Egyptian civilization was a black civilization, and ancient Egyptians were black according to the Greek scholars and the Roman scholars. Ancient Egypt became white only in the 19th century and in the 20th century. And the scholar who is responsible for this is Seligman. The noted anthropologist from England, Seligman. White supremacy argues that blacks are inferior than white intellectually. They are subhuman and they are incapable of building a civilization. White supremacy had one dilemma until Seligman came. The dilemma was ancient Egypt was black according to the Greek and the Roman scholars. 10 of them said that, including Aristotle and Plato. 10 of them said that in writing. They had this dilemma, ancient Egyptian was black. So if blacks are inferior intellectually and are incapable of building a civilization, how come the ancient Egyptians built a civilization? Seligman found the solution for this dilemma. He came up with a theory called the Hamite theory. He separated the blacks who built a civilization in Egypt and Ethiopia from the rest of the black race, and he called them brown-skinned whites, or the Hamites. So Seligman saved white supremacy from this dilemma, and all the white scholars followed him from that time on. This was at the end of the 19th century. And since that time, white scholarship says that ancient Egypt is white.
Mustafa Hefni is currently working on his doctorate degree at Wayne State University. His dissertation topic is a content analysis of the treatment of ancient Egypt in world history textbooks. And just how far is this determined Egyptian willing to go to be classified black?
I want to carry my case all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court if necessary.
All right, we're back. Now, there you go. You see that? Now, I brought this out and put that for a long time ago, but I think the time is right now for you to get it one more time. This is what you're up against. Remember, I think it was last show I did, a show before last. I be doing so many, I can't keep up with all of them. I don't have the paperwork in front of me. But I told you about Jack Johnson. You remember that? Jack Johnson rose to the top of all the brothers that he was boxing against over that way we were. But now, here go the European on the side that is, oh, well, we the top champions of the world and all that. But Jackson, well, okay, hold on a minute, man. Let's settle this here for real in real life. Give me a shot at the title. What did they say? Well, no, you black people are yellow. They are not capable of doing this right here. This is a white man's sport, and I can't, you know, stoop down to giving you. Okay, that's fine. You are hailing yourself as the champion of the world. Give me a shot, and the whole world will be looking and determine and know for a fact who the real man is on earth. Well, now we're not going to give you a shot to finally Jack cornered him, and it happened in Las Vegas. And you know I don't really like no cussing, but goddamn. But anyway, let's go on down down the road here, and let's get on back down up in some more law.
Yeah, so what most people don't realize is there's actually a strategy that will allow you to sell your home and pay zero taxes on the gain from that sale. It's called the Section 121 Homeowners Exclusion. And what it says is if you live in a house 2 out of the last 5 years, when you sell that home, you're exempt from taxes on the first $250,000 if you're single, or the first $500,000 if you're married. So one of our clients a few years ago, they lived in a home for 1 year, they rented it out for 2 years, and they were about to sell it. They were going to have $200,000 of gain from this property. What we told them is go back and live in that house for one extra year. So therefore, they live in it 2 out of the last 4 years, right, which still qualifies, and they were able to sell the home for $300,000 more than what they paid for it and pay zero taxes on the sale. This is what happens when you use the tax code the right way.
You know that if a policeman gives you a ticket, cop gives pulls you over and gives you a ticket, that is called a ticket in commerce.
Uh-huh.
And so if you go to buy something and you don't have the money and it's too expensive, you ask me to co-sign for you. Now, if I co-sign for you to buy something and I co-sign on the ticket, that means if you don't pay it, I have to, right?
Right.
Therefore, when the cop gives you a ticket, he signs it first. It's called a ticket in commerce.
Right.
Because money is going to change hands.
Right.
Therefore, when you sign it, you are the co-signer of the ticket in commerce. Well, as a co-signer, you don't have to pay the ticket. You were just the co-signer, and you can decide, I don't think I want to pay that ticket. And then you send the ticket and the paperwork to the Secretary of State, and they then give it to the Attorney General. The Attorney General then sends it back to the cop, and the cop has to pay the ticket because he's the one that signed it first. You were just a co-signer. But as long as you don't understand this, people don't understand the way banks and commerce work.
And government.
And government,
and
religion, and
taxes.
It's all one big show. And if you're not licensed to play in the show, George Carlin used to say, it's a big club and you ain't in it.
You can deduct mortgage interest on your tax return. You can deduct property taxes on your tax return. The standard deduction is about $14,000 for 2024 for a single individual. The tax advantage might be that deducting the mortgage interest and property taxes might equal more than what the standard deduction would be on your tax return, allowing you to save money on your income tax when you file.
Three things about the banking system that you probably don't know. First thing that you probably don't know is that every time you make a deposit, every time you put a dollar in, they get $10 on your behalf. You put $10 in, they get $100. Put $100 in, they get $1,000. You make a $1,000 deposit, they get $10,000 worth of credit on your behalf. The second thing that you probably don't know about the banking system is that they file a 1099-A on your behalf every year. Meaning that you don't even want your bank deposits back because you didn't even realize that you can get your bank deposits back from the bank if you filed on your behalf. That's why the third thing you probably don't know. The third thing you probably don't know is that you can file a 1099-D on your own bank deposits. Meaning that what? You get back 10 times the amount, from 1 times to 10 times back the amount of money that you put into the bank every year.
My home is in a trust. Do I still own my home? The short answer is no, the trust owns your home. The more relevant question is, who owns the trust? The answer there is your trustees, the people that you've chosen to act on your behalf because you can trust them to do the things you want them to do. If you're putting your home into a trust, you can also be a trustee, and this way you can stay in control of the home for the rest of your life. And now, because you no longer own the home, it's owned by the trust, this can help protect it from all kinds of future events, including care fees protection. Remember, this is a separate legal entity, and it would be correct to say that you no longer own your home. You simply control it for the rest of your days. And remember, if you don't own it, they can't take it from you.
Do not ever let your parents give you the house. Instead, do what the rich do. Son, I'm retiring and I'm giving you the house. Dad, you tripping. Don't put that in my name. What? Do you not want the house? Of course I do, but you've owned a property for a really long time and the property value has appreciated a lot. Which means if you was to transfer the property in my name today, I'll be responsible for paying all the capital gains taxes when I sell it. Man, it can't be that bad. So you got the property for $50,000 and now it appraised for $500,000. If you transfer the property in my name and I sold it today, I'll have to pay over $100,000 in capital gains taxes. That's a lot of money. So what should I do? Instead, you should put the property in the living trust and add me as a beneficiary. So when you are alive in 30 years, I can inherit the property tax-free through the stepped-up and cost basis. Okay, so how do I put my house in the living trust? First thing you do is get a copy of your current deed. Then you want to prepare a copy of a new deed. You can use a quitclaim deed or a grant deed. On that form, the grantor will be your name and the grantee will be the living trust name. After you finish the entire form, you want to sign and date it in front of a notary. Then you want to take it to your local land record office and file it there. And once that's completed, your home will be in the trust. Got it. So don't transfer assets in your kid's name. Open up a trust instead. Exactly. That way we pay no capital gain taxes and we build generational wealth. Wow, son. Who taught you all this? I simply just follow the real melanin king.
7 rules of money. 1. Pay yourself first. 2. Learn to invest. 3. Make your money work for you. 4. Don't be a slave to money. 5. Always have an emergency fund. 6. Have a plan and set goals. And 7. Spend less than you earn. If you want to improve your life, read the caption for a minute.
All right, we're back. Okay. I had to get this stuff together and put it in a nutshell so we can come out here on Blog Talk Radio and put it out here and just remind you one more time. For you to actually get this here done and do something with it, targetdataelimination.org. We got it for you. You only deal with one step at a time. One time. You know it. One time you practicing, one time you gonna give it a shot, and one time, woo, it worked. Okay, let's roll, man. Let's rock and roll. Now, before we get down into I gotta make sure that I done dealt with all of the law here. Because I want to try to get this to help me as best I can to make sure that I got everything already covered. We're going to go right here. We'll be right back. Yeah, hold on a minute.
Antonio Pigafetta, a Venetian scholar, and Ferdinand Magellan, both explorers, took their first voyage to the Americas in 1519. In 1526, they came across the indigenous people of Brazil, whom they describe as resembling giants, and they are all black and go quite naked, except that they are covered in their natural parts. In Pigafetta's journal, they describe the indigenous people of Brazil as being so black that they look like they step out of the infernos of hell. Also, many people in Brazil who saw these giants said they were so black that they describe them as infernal devils. A 10,000-year-old Negroid skeleton nicknamed Apunaman has been found in the Americas. Apunaman was found in the same area where they found Lucia, the 12,000-year-old Negroid skeleton that was found in Brazil. Apunaman bears a strong resemblance to Lucia, and many people think they could even be related. A 3D reconstruction of a Puna man's skull showed that he was a Negro indefinitely. Make sure you guys subscribe. I'm going to be doing a full-length video on this shortly.
You see, what happened with those African or Polynesian-looking skulls was that they were tested for DNA when DNA technology was not as advanced as it is today. And what that DNA showed was that they were more closely related to modern Native Americans than they are to any other people in the world. So the notion that there was some connection with Polynesia or Africa was dismissed. But now that we have very firm evidence of an Australasian genetic signal, Australian Aborigines, Papua New Guinea, Melanesians, with those kind of features, now that we have the genetic evidence that is found in the Amazon, we have to go back to that old evidence and reconsider it.
Our people have been in the Americas for a very long time.
Twa people. Case in point, Twa people, the Dogon, the some parts of the Dravidians, your people in the South Pacific, your people in the rainforest down in South America, indigenous people.
These are the images of Africans who were known as the Olmecs, who were part of the ruling class in Mexico for hundreds of years, and they left these images all throughout Mexico. They inspired the creation of the calendar, architecture, engineering, cosmology.
While I disagree with the African part, they are indigenous Negroes of the Olmecs.
Have you ever wondered who the first inhabitants of America were? Dr. Clyde Winters, a respected anthropologist, argues they were black or of African heritage. His theory is backed by compelling DNA evidence that challenges the long-held belief that Native Americans descended from East Asians. Instead, Winters highlights African haplogroups found in Native Americans but not in East Asia. Adding to this, he points to archaeological sites in Brazil that show signs of African presence as far back as 100,000 years ago. Even Oprah Winfrey's DNA test revealed Native American ancestry, supporting Winters' theory despite initial skepticism due to her dark skin. Dr. Winters also finds linguistic links between early American languages and African languages, reinforcing his argument of an African origin. His research offers a fascinating rewrite of history, presenting a deeper connection between African people and the first Americans.
Event 49 says, a black people came to Haiti from the south or southeast who had darts of guanin metal and were called the Black Guaninis. This tradition preserved by Herrera, Garcia, and Charlebourg indicates a colony of Negroes or men painting black from South America. They might be the black Negroes of Quarenqua mentioned by Dangleria or some other American Negro nation, of which there are many. Again, they might be some other American Negro nation, of which there are many, many black nations. See my account of ancient black nations of America, says the author.
Have you ever wondered about the origins of Native Americans? For a long time, the prevailing belief was that Native American groups from Central and South America traced their origins back to a single ancestral population. This theory stemmed from genetic studies that pointed to a common lineage. Yet, a more complex scenario started to emerge when scientists began examining some of the oldest skeletons found on the continent. These ancient remains showed morphological diversity, physical characteristics that didn't quite align with the single origin theory. The skeletons bore traits that were more akin to indigenous Australians, New Guineans, and Andaman Islanders than any present-day Eurasian or Native American groups. This unexpected revelation hinted at a more intricate tapestry of human migration and settlement in the Americas than previously assumed.
In ancient times, we were always in the Americas, keeping our traditions and taking care of family. And then, all of a sudden, Christopher Columbus showed up, talked to some of our elders, deceived them, took them as captives back to Europe, and those same indigenous people that were taken to Europe were brought from Europe to Africa, and then back to the Americas, reclassified as Negro slaves. Then later, in the 1920s, you had Walter Plecker, who took all the American Indians that looked dark-skinned or Negroid and reclassified them as colored. And now today, we're just proud African Americans.
You was using your TP to help you travel so you can be able to live in the wilderness, in the plains. But it was cities in America. I'm talking about the Indians had cities that was made out of stone. And if you're looking at this encyclopedia, it's pretty much gonna tell you that they had apartment complex. Right? How do you have, if you can build an apartment complex, or if you can build pyramids made out of stone, why would you even need to live inside a sheet made out of bison skin? It's certain stuff like that that wouldn't even cross your mind. Like, why would they need that? They wouldn't need no stuff like that, man. They wouldn't. If you're looking at what they had, man, they had running water. Like, come on, now they had running water in their house because the Indians dealt with pipelines and pipe structures. It's crazy. Like, how come they don't talk about...
Evidence shows that black Africans founded the early civilization in China, known as the Li Min, or black-headed people, during the Zhou Dynasty. Legendary Chinese Emperor Fu Xi, often depicted as a woolly-haired black man, originated from the oracle of the I Ching. The true origins of martial arts, such as karate and wrestling, can be traced back to Africa, not the regions often believed. Imhotep's tomb carvings show ancient fighting techniques, proving how far back Kemetic arts go. The original people of India, the Dravidians, were African. They founded the Indus Valley civilization and restored spiritual sciences like yoga and kundalini. African Ethiopians influenced ancient Chinese medicine, which shares the Egyptian Kemetic view of reality as a unified field, connected by the Tao. Ultimately, Africans are the blueprint of civilization, and all others are variations. We are all linked by this connection, a product of Afrocentric culture. Did you know Mary McLeod Bethune is one of America's most inspirational daughters, educator, national civil rights pioneer, and champion of African-American women's rights and advancement, advisor to presidents of the United States. The first in her family not to be born into slavery, she became one of the most influential women of her generation. Dr. Bethune famously started the Daytona Literary and Industrial Training Institute for Negro Girls on October 3, 1904, with $1.50, vision, an entrepreneurial mindset, resilience, and faith in God. She created pencils from charred wood, ink from elderberries, and mattresses from moss-stuffed corn sack. Her first students were five little girls, and her five-year-old son, Albert Jr. In less than 2 years, the school grew to 250 students.
Ancient mounds in America built by Negroes even before Native American ancestors. Oldest skull found in North America. Ancient mounds in America stand as remarkable testaments to the rich history and cultural diversity that existed long before the arrival of European settlers. However, recent archaeological findings have shed new light on their origins, suggesting that they may have been built by African peoples even before the ancestors of the Native Americans. One intriguing discovery that challenges our understanding of America's ancient history is the finding of an exceptionally old skull in North America. This skull, dating back thousands of years, exhibits distinct African features, leading researchers to speculate about the possibility of an early African presence in the region. While further research is needed to fully understand the implications of this finding, it certainly adds an intriguing layer to the narrative of America's ancient past. These ancient mounds, regardless of their builders, hold immense cultural significance.
And Raffiness also believed that the Americas were populated by black indigenous peoples at the time of European contact.
And we know that to be true because of all of the primary sources, artifacts, archaeology, geology, and anthropology.
Okay, now let's get into the expo. Remember, he wrote this in 1832. The primitive black nations of America. To many, this fact of old black nations in America will be new, yet it is an important feature of an American history. I will here merely enumerate the black tribes of which I have found evident traces and remains in North and South America. Number one, the Araras or the Caroras of Cumana were black, but with fine features and long hair like the Jolofs and Galas of Africa. Number two, the Estoros, latitude 32, are like...
What if I told you that all the pyramids around the world are connected? That all the early civilizations around the world plugged into a black source for all their knowledge, wisdom, and understanding? This is something that esteemed scholar Anthony Browder has documented for years in hopes of bringing to light the connection between ancient American civilizations and structures with Nile Valley ones. Anthony T. Browder, a dynamic scholar and cultural historian, has spent his life unraveling the complexities of African history and culture. With a background in fine arts, Browder's creativity and intellect have beautifully intertwined, painting a vivid picture of the rich African heritage.
All right, we're back, ladies and gentlemen. Okay, now, let's go on down in here, and I want you to remember something. I know you've heard this before about Egypt being the grandbaby of a certain place in Africa. And I'm going to use that term. That's what everybody knows it as, is a place called Africa. However, just a baby. Okay? So let's take a look at the mamas and the daddies and the granddaddies and grandmamas and all of that. Let's take a look at some of that. Okay? Yeah, hold on a minute.
My brother and I read a book called The Mark of Oppression. And this mark, these two publishers, Cardiner and Overseer, said that they could not understand how is it that a group of people, African Americans, have been bludgeoned over their heads mentally and spiritually for hundreds of years and are still surviving. They couldn't understand it. And they said so in their book. The answer came out in 1996, why it is that not only have African Americans survived the worst mental and spiritual bludgeoning of any people in recorded history, but they are becoming champions of everything in which there is a level playing field. No matter what it is, we predominate in every field. This is why they won't teach our children African history, because they know that once our children get on the same level playing field as their white counterparts, that they will dominate just like we dominate in basketball, baseball, football, track and field, and anything else in which there is a level playing field. So that while they teach their children about the greatness of their European ancestors, they won't teach our children about the greatness of their African ancestors, because then that would be a level playing field in academia. And they know that we will predominate just like all of these examples we've given them, that our children predominate when they know who they are from the African historical point of view. Now, here's what I found out in 1996. A group of geneticists wrote this book.
Can you identify where they're from and
the group,
how it came about?
Yeah, okay. All right, sure. Yes, indeed. An organization is called the American Association for the Advancement of Science. The American Association for the Advancement of Science. Now, this organization is composed of people who study about DNA and the genome. And you've been reading about the DNA and the genomes. Well, this group of scientists came upon an idea by accident at first, that different groups of people had different numbers of DNA series.
Explain that.
Now, a DNA series means that when your DNA is located, and say they get a hair from your head and they subject it to certain tests, they say, well, this is the DNA of Minister Brown, and yours is different from everybody else in the world. All right? Then they found further that not only are their DNA series different, but the number of DNAs in there are different in different groups. Whites have a different number of DNA, and blacks have a different number of DNA series. apes have a different number of DNA series. Then they found this amazing thing, that the greater the number of DNA series, the smarter the person, the group is, the greater the probability of genius within that group. So they tested the orangutans, these 15 geneticists from around the world. Now, these geneticists came from 9 different universities. And we have here on the cover of the pamphlet they put out the names of these geneticists. And you can see them right there, right beneath the title of this pamphlet. Now, this pamphlet, most people have no idea what it means. But breaking it down, and after you study it and have it explained to you by a geneticist, a trained geneticist, you will find that they're talking about DNA series. Now, here are the names of these 15 geneticists from around the world, University of Japan, University of China. Yale University is the headquarters of this organization called the American Association for the Advancement of Science. And you see it down there. Now, this was copyrighted in 1996. All right. What it said is this, and this is the mind-blowing part. It said that when they tested the orangutan, they found out he only had 3 DNA series. When they tested the gorilla, they found out the gorilla has 4 DNA series. So he's a little smarter than the orangutan. They tested the chimpanzee, which is an ape, and found that he had 5 DNA series. Then they went all into the different races of the world. They went into Europe and tested the DNA series of the English, the French, the German, the Spanish, the Russians, and found they had 6 DNA series. Then they put all of this, what they found from around the world, on a map. And this map really is called the intelligence map of the world, because they tested 116 different human groups and found their DNA series numbers. All of them, all over the world, have 6. And they put the numbers in form of a little flag that you can see on this map. These little flags have a color. And they show... Oh, this is upside down. I'm sorry. Yeah. And they showed that the English have only 6, and it's all into Europe, only 6. Went over into Japan and China, and they only have 6. Over into America with a predominantly European, and they only have 6. Then they came to Africa, and they came to the part of Africa. Now, all the rest of them, they put in little flag colors. Those flag colors are orange-red, if you notice. But when they came to Africa, found out that the African people have 9 DNA series from here just below the Songhai Empire down to the foot of Africa. All those 10 nations, of which African Americans descended from one of them, we have 9 DNA series, the greatest possibility of genius in our group. Now it's answered this age-old question. How can a people survive being told they're nothing for 400 years, never allowed to learn that they came from beautiful cities, and told they came from a jungle. How could a people survive? How can a people become champions in everything they touch? Because they have 9 DNA series, while the rest of the world has only 6. This is why they copyrighted this. And you'll notice on the outside of this, now this map is taken, I took this map right from this page here. And I blew it up so that the world could see it. Even though this is copyrighted, I can't let you have this book because it's copyrighted.
Can you give us the title of the book?
The title of the book is called Global Patterns of Linkage, Disequilibrium at the CD4 Locus, and Modern Human Origins. Global Patterns of Linkage, Disequilibrium at the CD4 Locus, and Modern Human Origins. Now, you have to be a geneticist to even know what they're talking about. But when we broke it down and interviewed Dr. Kidd, the head, he's the chairman at Yale University, he broke it down into plain everyday English so that the world would know that the African American is descended from those people who gave to the world the Great Pyramid, gave to the world science, gave to the world mathematics. A black man named Ahmose gave algebra to the world 3,700 years ago. It's in the world books, it's in the encyclopedias. They don't want our children to know this, because then that would make the playing field level for white children. And you know what happens when they made the playing field level in basketball and allowed black men to play. Out of 29 of the top seeded players in the world today, 28 are African American. When they opened up the Penn Relays, when they opened up the Olympics and allowed blacks to run back in 1932, we've won all the gold medals. And the same thing will happen in the classroom when they allow our children to learn their African history. That's what this is saying. I hate to ask this question because it's embarrassing. How many of you who are African Americans, how many of you know the African city and country from which your ancestors were born? Except my daughter.
Not one hand went up.
Not one hand went up.
Mm-mm.
I asked this question of 500 whites. How many of you know the city and country? I was teaching at a university, a white university, just outside Philadelphia. Every hand went up. They knew not only the country from which they came, not only the city, but the borough from which their ancestors came. Now, how come they know and none of you know? Here's the reason. And here's the reason why I am different. The reason is that the South Carolina and North Carolina plantation owners went to Germany to find out how they could control our fathers and mothers on the plantation. But they were getting out of hand. They were burning the houses down. They were killing white folks. They were doing everything negative about being in captivity. They were never slaves. They were prisoners of war, the war of 1591. So what happened was they sought the advice of an expert in Songhai history. Now, his name was Johann Blumenbach, and he was the head of the Department of History at the University of Göttingen in Germany.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And how many of you know this? I know you was taught this in college and everything, all you college folks. Mm-hmm. Well, when they sought his advice,
right,
they said, do you Do they know that they're the Songhai people? So the plantation owners who traveled over there to seek his advice said, well, of course they know that they come from the great Songhai Empire. Well, that's your problem. You can't let them know that they came from greatness, from grandeur, from beauty, from sophistication. You'll never be able to control them. So the plantation owner said, well, how can we prevent it? I mean, the mothers and the fathers would tell the children, say, you came from Timbuktu and you came from the city of Jane, and that's where we were born. And then the Europeans came over and invaded us in 1591 and marched us to the seas, to the waiting ship. Man, you can't allow them to learn, teach that to their children. They said, well, how are you going to stop it? Here's how you do it. Here's why you don't know where you're from. Boombox said, what you do? As soon as a boatload arrives, take the babies out the mama's arms. Send the parents to a distant plantation and work them to death and raise the children to believe they came from a jungle. They won't know the difference.
That's right.
How would they know?
That's right.
Their parents are gone. Now, here's the difference between me and you. When they captured my grandmother, I'm not going through, you heard the beginning of the story. My grandfather was a lawyer and a sculptor in Benin City, Nigeria. And the English kept on coming over, stealing his sculpture.
Wow.
Some of his sculpture ended up at the Art Museum in West Philadelphia, where they came to show it off because it was world-class sculpture.
So you, have you been able to see this sculpture?
Oh, sure.
Wow.
Yeah, I've got some in the book.
Incredible.
But anyhow, what happened was his wife hassled him and said, don't fight the English when they come over. Just let them have the sculpture. I'm pregnant. And they'll kill you. Then I'll be a widow. And they'll put me on board ship and take me over there where they're taking all the rest of those prisoners of war. But my grandfather, whose name was Mwale.
Mwale.
Said, I'm fighting them. I'm not going to let them steal my sculpture anymore. And he gathered some of his fellow sculptors. And they fought the English when they came over to steal. They were always stealing some. And they killed him. Killed my grandfather and put his wife, his pregnant wife, my great-great-great-grandmother on board the ship. And the ship was named Jesus, by the way. I've been angry ever since. Well, at Jesus, I mean, not at Jesus, but at Jesus. And on the way over, the baby was born.
Wow.
All right? Name of Diane. She named Diane. Now, it was bound for South Carolina. How many of your ancestors came from South Carolina? Raise your hand.
Oh, boy. A
whole bunch of folks. They were bound for South Carolina. But in 1808, this was 1813. In 1808, a law was passed by Congress forbidding more importations of the Songhai people. We're
That's
the
right.
Songhai people.
Right.
See, Blumenbach said, don't allow them to even learn that
That's
they
right.
came from the Songhai
That's
Empire.
Right. We're going to try to breed them here on this continent
That's
rather
right.
than continuing
That's right.
the cultural memory.
They don't even let them learn the name Songhai. Because then they'll start investigating. Then take away their ability to read and write. Pass laws against them learning to read and write. Then they can't learn anything about the Songhai Empire. They passed the law. 200 years of law not allowing blacks to learn to read and write. Well, anyhow. In 1808, this law was passed forbidding any more importations of Songhai people. Now, nobody paid any attention to that law at all except one little group called abolitionists. Now, the abolitionists put their money together and they bought a ship. And they patrolled the seas looking for prisoner of war ships, which you all were trained to say slave ships. They weren't slave ships. They were prisoner of war ships.
Very important.
Well, coming, very important distinction.
That's right.
And when we teach our children, they were never slaves.
That's
they
right.
were children, descendants of prisoners of war.
like McLean.
That's right.
A prisoner of war.
That's right.
He wasn't a slave.
That's right.
He got captured by the enemy.
That's right.
On the way, this abolitionist ship captured the ship that my great-great-grandmother was on. So instead of this baby being taken from my arms in South Carolina, the ship was towed to Trenton, New Jersey.
Hmm.
And of course, Nzinga, who was the baby's mother, my great-great-great-grandmother, taught the baby that her father was a world-class sculptor, that her father was a lawyer, that he went to world-class universities. So I was trained from babyhood, you know, that we've got to right this wrong.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
So I was, you know, it's your job, because you were spared by just an act of God, an act of the ancestors, to not let the baby being taken from Nzinga's arms, and the baby grew up, and she had a child. Her name is Mary Diane Thomas.
Mm-hmm.
And she was my great-grandmother, and she helped raise me.
Wow.
And so she told me the story when I was a kid, you see. So that's how I know.
Wow.
Where we're from.
Wow.
So. All right, everybody, we're back, and we're still rolling on. There you have it. Now, the biggest thing that we're going to have, the biggest hurdle that we're going to have to deal with, we ain't got no choice. We eventually going to have to deal with it, because the word is out. The Americas is ancient, ancient, ancient. Okay? You follow me? Don't get mad with me if we put the ancient Ethiopians in the Americas. Don't get mad with me if we put the ancient Songhai Empire in the Americas. Don't get mad with me if there's evidence in the Americas of the ancient Egyptians. Don't get mad with me. Please don't. Let's roll, y'all.
The reason why Africans went in was because of a preemptive strike. And because of this, and because we lack an understanding, we have to go back to the Punic Wars, of which there were three, that happened before the Common Era, basically give or take 300, maybe 200. This is the time of Hannibal Barca, who went to war with the Romans. Hannibal Barca. B-A-R-C-A. This is the Hannibal that we see that's going up into the Alps with elephants and defeating the Romans. There are things that we need to understand about the history of this area out of Tunis. This is where Carthage, or what we call Carthage, was.
It seems to result from the most careful investigation that the principal commerce of the interior of Africa has always been carried on in two directions. That which has been described from Ethiopia through the valley of the Nile, and that of the Sudan from the Niger to the Mediterranean coast. The western end of the road starting from Carthage ran in a southeasterly direction through the Fezzan to the site of the present Mursuk. After making the junction at that point with the Egyptian road, it turned southwards to the Niger and was the road which has been so often mentioned as the Tripoli-Fezzan road of the present day. Along this road, the Carthaginians traded with the Niger for carbuncles, skins, gold, ivory, and other goods. Thus, we get on unquestionable authority evidence of a well-established connection in very early times between Ethiopia and Egypt by the valley of the Nile, between Egypt and Carthage by a road crossing the desert through Siwa and Augala, and between Carthage and the Niger by the present Tripoli-Fezzan route. If we take Mirzuk and Thebes as lying almost on the same parallels of latitude outside the Tropic of Cancer, and Gao and Meroe as having also almost parallel positions on the edge of the summer rains, some 8 degrees farther south, we get the four corners of an irregular parallelogram, of which three sides were in permanent communication with each other.
These were the cousins to the Phoenicians who were in present-day Lebanon, and these were the traders, and these were the merchants. Phoenicia basically comes from the word purple. And as Dr. Ivan Van Sertima tells us, purple was the color of royalty. Purple was a color that was looked upon as a very important color. Purple was with the Greek Empire. Purple was with the Senate in the Roman Empire. Purple was a color that was traded for generations and generations because it had an important esoteric value. Purple is the last color as it relates to the rainbow. You go from infrared to ultraviolet. So these Phoenicians, these traders in the color purple, dealt with their cousins who also were traders from Cartadas. And this is why they were wealthy Africans in Tunis.
The civilization of the Phoenicians, contemporary at least in part with the history of Egypt, dates also from the earliest periods of which civil history has any record. The Phoenicians are believed to have migrated from Eritrea on the coast of the Red Sea about the year 2000 BC to the Mediterranean, where they were first established on a strip of Syria between the chain of Lebanon and the sea, and afterwards took possession of a portion of Greece, of some of the islands of the Mediterranean, and of the principal promontories along the coast of Africa to the Straits of Gibraltar, and as far down the western coast as the mouths of the Senegal. They also colonized Spain and spread up the coast of Western Europe, navigating as far as the Baltic and the English Channel. Carthage, of later growth, is believed to have been founded about 853 BC. Other Phoenician cities on the coast of Africa were of far greater antiquity than Carthage, and Phoenician trade in the Gulf of Sali on the west coast of Morocco was famous for many centuries before the Romans gave to that part of the coast the name of Sinus Emporicus, or Merchant's Bay. Phoenicia, like Syria, was never one state, but from the earliest period down to the Persian monarchy, was always divided into a number of separate cities, each with its little territory around it. Allied cities in Phoenicia were very numerous, and it is thought probable that there may have been periods when all the cities of Phoenicia formed one confederation, at the head of which at one time stood Sidon, and at a later period, Tyre. Throughout the colonies of Phoenicia, as well as in the mother country, a common religion formed likewise a bond of union for the cities and strengthened and preserved the connection between them. The chief authority was placed in the hands of kings, who in turn were to some extent controlled by high priests. The revenues of the cities depended in large measure on their trade, and the Phoenicians have lived in history as a commercial people. Through a considerable portion of their history, the Phoenicians appear to have acted as commercial agents for Egypt. As they sailed, it is related that they landed on the coasts, sowing the land and waiting for harvests. Thus, a tradition of them lingers on the west coast as well as on the east, and to them it is in some quarters believed that the legend of the first white men in western Negro land may be traced. Carthage had intercourse across the desert with Negro land, and drew thence its supply of elephants as well as gold and carbuncles. We may perhaps therefore carry back the date to a period when the Phoenicians dominated Egyptian politics and the worship of Astarte or Venus Erycina was common in the Valley of the Nile. It is interesting also to observe in Egyptian records the constant reference to magicians of the south. The part which magic played in the chronicles of Egypt is of course a matter of common knowledge. The whole north coast of Africa was, we are told, protected by talismans, burning glasses, and other marvels raised on pedestals which were placed at intervals along the shore. Alexandria could not be built till talismans had been erected, which had power to protect it from the monsters of the deep.
So that to understand who the Moors were, you have to step back. You have to go beyond 710, 711 AD. Who were these people that went into Spain? And you would have to understand that the Moors, they were the Etruscans. The Etruscans were Africans that had built the city known as Etruria. Etruria is the country we today call Italy. The Etruscans were on the islands of Sardinia, on the island of Corsica. They were developing civilizations in the Mediterranean basin. There were Africans that were in Spain 1,000 years before the Common Era. We have to see that the language of the Etruscans comes directly out of the Niger-Congo language, which goes from West Africa through Central Africa to Southern Africa. It is the base upon which Kiswahili is based. It is the language upon which most Africans are now in dialogue to. The largest group of Niger-Congo speakers are the Bantu people. I don't care for the word Bantu, but the basic thing is that these are the well-melanated Africans that show evidence of the civilization of linguistical culture comes out of the Niger-Congo language, and this was the language spoken in the Mediterranean basin. When you go over to Turkey, this was an African place. When you go to Greece, it was African. When you go over into Italy, it was African. And guess what? The capital of the country, Etruria, was called Rumae, R-U-M-A. We're talking linguistics now. That is why the capital of Italy today is called what? Rome. It came directly out of this. All of the Roman baths, all of the Roman civilizations, the architecture of Rome came from the Etruscans. These were the individuals that had settled in this area thousands of years ago when there were no other cultural groups in this area. There were no Greeks. There were no Romans. This is what most modern-day cultural anthropologists don't want to talk about, because you'd have to give credit to the people who developed these civilizations.
Do you know who the Moors are? Because, you know, you have to bring, one of the things that I've learned, to get people to come in, you have to meet them where they are at.
Peace, 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 peace. I'm Rami. Thank you for watching. Thank you for joining us. Now, before we get started with the video, I just want to put this disclaimer out there. This video is for everybody, you know, no matter what your nationality or what country you're from. But I'm making it specifically for the people that identify brothers and sisters as Black, Negro, colored, African-American, Black American, foundational Black American, any of those labels. If you identify as one of those, then this video is for you. And I humbly ask that you just listen and watch with an open mind, listen to the information and the knowledge, and then do some research on it. And stick to the end. I'm going to come back and we're going to talk about it a little more. But right now, let's get right to the videos.
Who are you? You don't know. Don't tell me Negro. That's nothing.
A different type of
European, like Black Europeans.
Right.
They wouldn't be considered Africans?
Well, you would be considered an African if you're from Africa. If you're from
so,
if,
so
if
let me,
born
let,
in
no,
Europe,
no, wait a minute, Willie. Now,
Europe,
wait a minute. No, listen. So here I'm considered an African-American, correct? Yeah.
That's what they say, but you're
that's
really
what they
not
say.
An African-American.
I'm not, it's possible.
You're
it's impossible
American.
For me to be. No, nah, I'm a Moor. Like, I'm
okay,
different.
Well, you're a Moor, then.
I'm a Moor. Like, I'm
okay,
different.
Well, you're a Moor, then.
I'm a Moor. Like, I'm
okay,
different.
Well, you're a Moor, then.
Who are you? You don't know. Don't tell me Negro. That's nothing.
Your band, why is your band called the Moors?
Moors is, I had a time during growing up where I went through a little kind of a shift in consciousness where I was like, I want to get back to roots and I want to get back to where I come from and my people and start studying on it. So Moors was one of the many civilizations that I came across, which was a beautiful manifestation a while ago of black royalty and beauty. And so I wanted, if I was going to name my band anything, for it to have the spirit of ancient civilizations that were, you know, that were great. So Moors was the one I chose.
You know, it's a lot of people don't know about the Moors when they, you know, ruled Europe and built more universities and built, you know, and educated that region of the world, right? A lot of people don't know that story. So it's very dope to see that.
What were you before the white man named you a Negro? And where were you? And what did you have? What was yours? What language did you speak then? What was your name? It couldn't have been Smith or Jones or Bunch or Powell. That wasn't your name. They don't have those kind of names where you and I came from. No, what was your name? And why don't you now know what your name was then?
Niggas be like, yo, Walker said he's not black. You're right. I'm not the Black America, call me. And it's just hard for a nigga to be from the slums, the ghetto, the hood, whatever. Niggas want to say where you're from. And then when you become this celebrity, you get to walk around the world, get to travel around the world, you get to touch the people, and get to find out the truth. And then when you get back home, what you call America, and you start telling the truth, the people you see that's in your community that's still plugged in the matrix and still trapped into what society tells you is reality. And you know it's not reality. You know it's not the truth, and it's hard to explain it.
When you talk black, white, people of color, you know, that comes with legal concepts, that come with legal terms. And then when you look up the definitions of these words, right, when you look up the definition of black, it, you know, we want to change the definitions of words, but we can't. You know, language is what language is. But when you go to the dictionary and you look up the definition of black, first thing that's in that box next to the word black, it says adjective. Now, we know that a noun is a person, place, or thing. An adjective, you are not a person. So when you classify as black in terms of race, you're basically taking yourself out of personhood, and that's the definition. Now,
you truly learning still. You truly just experiencing false statements and false lifestyles. And it's hard to explain. But just know, my nigga, like, I'm black. You know what I'm saying? But I ain't the Black America side, yeah.
What do we call ourselves? What are we? Are we this? Are we that? The same is true as what happened to us as a people. I mean, did we come in the original years? I mean, there's evidence of Africans here that go back 100,000 years. There's evidence of a black woman in San Diego, California. Her bones dated 90 to 80,000 years ago.
Man. In this system, we've been classified as Negro, colored, black,
colored.
Afro-American, African-American, some other. We've been called everything but American. We can't claim our nationality as Americans. And so, therefore, there's been this second-class status when you say black as a race. So they have us talking race, okay, when there's really race is a social construct. It really doesn't exist. So when we classify as black, that means that in this system, right, you are classifying as someone who doesn't have nationality or claim to the land, which they call birthrights.
There's a lot of conversation right now around reparations and so on and so forth, but as I have been enlightened by Brother Jay Morrison, we can't get reparations because we haven't been officially classified as a nationality. African American is not a nationality. Black is not a nationality. So you can't give reparations to people who don't have an official nationality, a flag, a constitution, and you have a seat at the UN. You know what I'm saying? And also, so when we speak, when people ask me about reparations, I'm like, well, that's kind of putting the cart before the horse.
Now, when we talk about the social construct of race, scientifically, biologically, science has confirmed that there is no such thing as race, okay? Now, there are racial classifications, just like in South Africa where they had apartheid. We are in a color-coded apartheid system that talks about us as black people, white people, yellow people, people of color. We have all been taken out of our nationalities, white folk included. You grew up with Irish, Italian, Greek, Polish. Now they all classify as white. We, you know, Aboriginals born here in America, your mama born here, your grandmama born here, your great, 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 all them, you know, everybody, we come from the land. But our nationality has been stripped and taken away from us, and we're put in these color-coded boxes, and we're governed, we're ruled under this colored apartheid system of black, white, red, yellow, blue, people of color.
We all have to sit down and share information. And instead of arguing over arguing with each other over who's right and who's wrong, let's put our information on the table and as a group come to a consensus of at least the science of what's going on and stop fighting amongst ourselves, particularly when some of us exhibit deep ignorance in terms of where we're coming from and why we're saying what it is that we're saying, because our children are watching us. And we must conduct ourselves in a way that they respect us. But we must act respectfully to get respect from them. And I believe we have to have open conversations and respect and love each other enough to let everybody's information go out there and don't put somebody down because they may not think like you.
Definitely.
You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So that I think that in answer to both of your questions, what I'm trying to do is show the roundabout way that we can begin to look at ourselves and to be able to respond to ourselves in ways that it makes sense.
All right. Much love and respect to Scarface and Willie D, Ghetto Boys Reloaded. Much love to Waka. Much love to Isaiah Thomas. Much love to Kaba Hiawatha Kamene and all the elders and the scholars and the teachers and the brothers and sisters who have been doing their best to get this information to help wake our people up, to help free our minds from the mental slavery that we're suffering from or enslavement that we're suffering from. I'm going to show you real quick. I could get into the text and get academic with you, Golden Trade of the Moors. We got the Golden Age of the Moor, Ivan Van Sertima. We have Stolen Legacy by George G.M. James, from Babylon to Timbuktu. We have, from the Christian perspective, you know what I mean, the European, Dogs of God, Columbus, the Inquisition, and the Defeat of the Moors. So this coming from the op side, the story of the Moors in Spain. Like, I could get into the academic and show you the research and the examples and all of that, but none of that will matter if you don't change your thinking. You know what I mean? I'm talking to you right now. Yes, you, brother. Yes, you, sis. It's going to be, and can't nobody convince you of who you are. You're going to have to do the research and do the knowledge yourself. You're going to have to free your own mind. You know what I mean? None but ourselves. By my, anyways, my point is, let's keep it simple. Our ancestors, we were identified as Moors at one time, keeping it real simple. They lost power. They were defeated. As a result of that, the people that defeated them enslaved them. And part of the enslavement, part of the conditioning to keep our ancestors and the generations after, part of the conditioning to keep us in that state, in that condition of enslavement, was to strip us from our name and our heritage and our culture and our identity as Moors and all the great things our ancestors and our people did when we were identified as Moors, to take that away from us and instead replace it with a new label, black or Negro or colored, and now African American. That's essentially what happened. I mean, we're talking about hundreds of years, but the condensed version is we were doing our thing, we were amazing, we were giving out science and culture and knowledge and all of this mathematics. We got defeated.
the people that defeated us, enslaved us, and took away our name and gave us a different name. That and right now, in order to free ourselves from that enslavement, not the physical chains, you know what I mean, but from the mental enslavement, to free us from that condition, to help us rise again, we have to reclaim our identity. That's why it's important to identify yourself as a Moor, if you're wondering. And I know it's a lot of videos out there. It's a lot of people saying, oh, if you call yourself a Moor, you can do this. And you, I'm not even trying to get into all of that. I'm just saying on a very basic level, that's why it's important. It's important to know who you are and who your ancestors were. You know what I mean? Sankofa, look it up. It's an African concept, S-A-N-K-O-F-A, Sankofa. Yeah, and I don't even want to get too much deeper into it other than to state that this person here, Noble Drew Ali, you may have heard him, you may not have heard about him. He was the first person, in, as far as I've seen in the research, that came specifically to the so-called black man, the so-called Negro, and told him, this is who you truly are. This is your history, and started giving us this information. And he did this before Google, before the internet, before you could just do-do-do, look it up. You know what I mean? This is back in the early 1900s. He was born in 1886, created the Moore Science Temple of America, the organization. I don't even want to get that deep in it. But what I do want to say is, if you're listening to this and you have an open mind, and you've been feeling like, I know that I'm not black because my skin ain't, you know what I mean? And those labels I don't identify as Negro. If you know that, if you feel that, if you've been wondering who you truly are, what your identity truly is, then I humbly ask you to just look into Moore's history. Don't believe me. You know what I mean? You ain't got to believe the people that you see on the internet or anything like that. Go to a library and just look up Moore's history. Look up who the Moors were, what they were doing in the 700s, 800s, 900s, and continue that all the way up into 1492, the 1500s, 1600s, and so on and so forth. And you'll see a shift. You'll see our people being identified as Moors, and then there's a shift that takes place. You know what I mean? And we get defeated. 1492 is the year that Columbus discovered America. That's also the year, coincidentally, that the Moors were defeated, coincidentally. But I don't want to get too much more into it. I wanted to keep it short and sweet. If you have questions, please reach out. Hit me in the comments section. Hey, I'm interested. I want to understand more about this. I can give you some resources, some things to check out, some books to read, so that you can confirm it for yourself. And if you're one of the brothers and sisters who's like, I'm not a Moor, I'm not, that's cool. You know what I mean? This ain't that. This ain't trying to force people to identify as Moors or to convince you as that. If you want to call yourself black, you can do that. But, you know, with love and respect, that label, it is not your true identity. You know what I mean? It's not who we truly are. And so, you know, from one brother to another or a sister, with love and respect, I say, man, do some research. You know what I mean? Do the knowledge. Learn who you are. You know what I mean? Know yourself. You know what I mean? Knowledge of self is the key. Got to wake ourselves up. Got to free our minds. Study Noble Drew Ali. You know what I mean? Yeah, and that's it. Much love to everybody. Keep shining. Keep educating us. Keep educating yourself, and as the elder Kabahai Wata Kamane says, it ain't over till we win. All right, peace.
Because this ain't just about knowing this. This is dead history if you just want to know it. When you see what the Moors did in science and in education, that's what I want to do. I want to go back to those days. You talk about make America great again? I want to make America Moorish again.
Drew Ali speaking about the Moorish history here in the United States of America. You know, these things that were talked about were just reminders of who we were in the past and what our fight has been in this country. We did not want to be called Negro. We did not want to be called a color. Dr. Martin Luther King said he did not want to be judged by the color of his skin, but by the content of his character.
The logic of the Moorish Science Temple as a movement. Drew Ali didn't pull this stuff out of his fez and make it up. There is a historical precedent for everything that he laid out. And as I, you know, have said earlier, if we ever needed a time to embrace what is contained in our Moorish literature, this is it.
All right, everybody, we're back. Now, the clock is fleeting. Says, let's go down here and do something about how did it get this way. We don't put it out there. We don't deal with the Phoenicians. We don't deal with the law and stuff. The Songhe, a high empire, we deal with all of it. Let's deal with a little bit of this right here. Now, y'all hold on a minute. If you got a question, raise your hand. Right now, we rolling.
Scientific racism, a critical analysis of Malaysians and Australians and the peopling of America by Nikki Llewellyn. The 1935 document, Malaysians and Australians and the Peopling of America, published by the Smithsonian Institute and written by Alice Acharthi-Laka, shows the early process of reasoning when determining the first peopling in the Americas. The scientific conclusion reached by Alice Acharthi-Laka about the Negro presence in America suggests a bias against Negro peoples. This document also contained blatant academic dishonesty and an overall dismissal of the Black presence in America before Columbus. Alice Acharthi-Laka, Racism and Rise to Power. When viewing this document, it is important to keep in mind the author's point of view on Negro people and the magnitude of influence Acharthi-Laka had on the world of academia. Acharthi-Laka was not born in America, but was a child of immigrants who migrated to America from Austria-Hungary and later moved to New York. He became the director of physical anthropology for expeditions sponsored by the American Museum of Natural History. And in 1910, he became the custodian of physical anthropology collections at the Smithsonian Institute. According to the Smithsonian Institute, quote, Acharthi-Laka was a curator at the United States National Museum, now the National Museum of Natural History, from 1904 to 1941. Acharthi-Laka traveled widely to collect skeletal remains and established the Smithsonian's world-renowned physical anthropology collections. In 1904, he came to head the newly created Division of Physical Anthropology at the National Museum of Natural History, a position he held for the next 40 years, end quote. He also developed the now challenged theory that the first people in America came from Asia across the Bering Strait. What is not readily known about Acharthi-Laka is that he believed in a form of scientific racism called eugenics, which held the belief that poor people and people of color were unfit to live. The Encyclopedia Britannica defines eugenics as, quote, the selection of desired heritable characteristics in order to improve future generations, typically in reference to humans. By World War I, many scientific authorities and political leaders supported eugenics. However, it ultimately failed as a science in the 1930s and 40s, when the assumptions of eugenics became heavily criticized and the Nazis used eugenics to support the extermination of entire races. End quote. Recently, an article released by the Washington Post titled Bone Rooms, Where Scientific Racists Stored Their Evidence, shows how mainly Black and Native American bones were illegally obtained and experimented upon. Over 30,000 bones now rest in the Smithsonian vaults. According to the article, quote, Bone Rooms tells the story of the worst legacies of colonial anthropology in the 19th and early 20th centuries. The bones of women and men who were loved by their families and might have been honored by them in death became mere objects for study. A central figure in this evolving story is Alice Acharthileika, a Czech-born anthropologist who in 1903 was named the Smithsonian's first curator of physical anthropology. Acharthileika's personality was as acerbic as his ethics were rocky. He essentially encouraged looting of human remains and aligned himself with the eugenics movement, end quote. The praised anthropologist, Alice Acharthileika, was a blatant racist who practiced scientific misconduct. Early accounts of Black people in America before Columbus, suppressed by Alice Acharthileika. From as early as 1607, early explorers held the notion that there were multiple migrations into the Americas. However, these accounts were dismissed by Acharthileika. Quote, as early as 1607, early explorers such as Padre Garcia entertained the thought of multiple migrations in the Americas, end quote. Quote, later, advocates of multiple American origins urged the acceptance of the theory that the Polynesians and Malaysians and even Australians participated in the peopling of North and especially South America, end quote. Quote, there are also some early references to Negroes on the American continent. The first to refer to this subject is Peter Martyr, who writing within 3 years after the discovery of the Pacific by Balboa and using information from letters received from the Isthmus, includes the following unaccredited passage in his third decade. There is a reason not past 2 days' journey distance from Cahuéca in which they found only Black Moors, and those exceeding fierce and cruel. They suppose that in time past, certain Black Moors sailed there out of Ethiopia to rob, and that by shipwreck or some other chance, they were driven to those mountains. The inhabitants of Cahuéca lie in continual war and debate with these Black men. End quote. In this section, Alice Acharthileika presents only two accounts about the presence of Black people in America before Columbus. Yet, there were many more accounts by early explorers who saw Black people in America. The presence of Black people in America was also expressed by Christopher Columbus in his journeys. Moreover, Alice Acharthileika says that Peter Martyr's account was unaccredited. Yet, Director of Native American Studies, Jack D. Forbes, at the University of California, Davis, provides this exact account and plenty more to show evidence of Black people in America before Columbus. More suppression of the evidence of Black people populating the Americas pre-Columbus were the changing narratives of anthropologists. In 1879, in one of his early reports on the skull found in America, archaeologist Quetzalfages states that the skull belonged to the Negroid family and suggested that there was a Black presence in America. No other group except Negroid was determined to represent the skull. though Quatrophages later changed his original narrative. According to Atrakileka, quote, in the second volume, however, published in 1889, there are a number of references to Malaysian elements in the New World. On page 308 of this volume, we read, the characteristics of the Lagoa Santa schools might make us think that the fossil race of Brazil belonged to the Negro type. But in the special memoir, which I have devoted to the subject, I have already stated that such an approach should be discarded. In reality, among the present population, there are those that have preserved in a remarkable manner the craniological type of Lagoa Santa and are evidently representatives at times, but very little admixed of this race. But none of these resemble the Negro in the general aspect, in color, in the hair, etc. While a large quantity of evidence shows them all the external characteristics to be very close to certain of the yellow races. End quote. In just 10 years, Quatrophages changed his narrative where he stated that the schools he tested were probably from Oceania or Africa, to stating that there was a small presence of black people in America before Columbus, and the majority of the people belonged to the yellow races. The question of why Quatrophages changed his narrative about the early peopling of the Americas should be investigated. Early peopling of America. Different theories? Anthropologist Ken Tate believes that the majority of the early peopling in America were from the Mongolian race in Asia, whereas, based on the same information, anthropologist Rivet compares the skulls to Negritic or Negro people. Quote, in 1917, Ken Tate still holds that the somatic characteristics of the American Indians taken as a whole are those of the yellow races in general. Also that one finds Americanoid types almost everywhere in Siberia, in the Himalayas, and the neighboring regions in China, Japan, Indonesia, and Polynesia. He believes he can distinguish in America at least six principal or primordial and perhaps many secondary races, some of which races, both principal and secondary, inhabit also certain parts of Eastern Asia and Oceania. He makes no point of the occurrence of the seemingly Malaysian-like skulls about La Paz and Lower California, and there is no reference in the paper to Malaysian or other blacks, end quote. Quote, utilizing also data on the small collection of Lower California remains preserved in the United States National Museum at Washington, furnished by Atrakileka. Rivet, in 1909, published a handsome report on the materials. He has obtained from the long bones the statues for the males and the characteristics of the available skulls, together with those of the other parts of the skeleton, led him to the following deductions. The Paracus in Lower California differ from the American races in general, and especially from the neighboring Indian populations in the proportions of their body and in certain number of the characteristics of their skeleton, which appear to approximate them to Negritic peoples, without, however, showing a perfect identity with the latter. In 1888, he amplifies this statement thus, today, I restrict myself to declaring that the physiognomic characteristics of the American heads show a divergence so manifest that it is necessary to renounce definitely the conception of a universal and common type of the American Aborigines. They too are a mixture of several original races, and the program of future researches will find its final expression in the separation of the distinct ethnic elements that have entered into the composition of the various living and extinct tribes. End quote. more accounts of early blacks in America. Quote, the year 1888 sees the publication by the Lund Museum of a volume of the Danish studies on the Lagoa Santa remains, and this includes communications on the human bones by Litgen and Hansen. He says, the type of skulls corresponds perfectly to the Papin type, and the bones of the limbs indicate a small or medium statue but robust body, a new resemblance with the Papins, end quote. Quote, in 1923, Mr. Tate, field assistant of the Department of Mammalogy, American Museum of Natural History, found in a ravine near the village of Punin, Central Ecuador, a human cranium without the lower jaw. We wish to emphasize that particularly the point that in claiming that this calvarium is australoid, we have in mind a basic racial relationship and do not believe that it necessarily represents migration from Australia or Malaysia. We feel that unless this is indeed a very remarkable case of parallelism, this type in America and the similar type in Australia and Malaysia are derivations of the same basal racial stock, end quote. Quote, the author, who next to Rivet, takes the most pronounced stance on the subject of the presence of Malaysians in America, is the esteemed veteran of French anthropologist and Rivet's close friend, R. Bernou. In 1922, he receives from a missionary two Indian skulls from Colombia. One of these is deformed, but the other, that of a recent Tenebo Indian who died of a snake bite and whose body was abandoned by his friends, is normal. All in all, Bernou decides, it now appears no longer permissible to doubt the great extension of the Papin type in the New World. Its traces, it was found possible to follow in space from Lower California to the southern extremity of the continent and from the Atlantic to the Pacific. In time, from the epochs of the race of Lagoa Santa to our day. Bernou admits it is true that there are still many gaps in our knowledge on the subject and that nothing is known as to the mode of the Papin migration, but those are his only concessions. End quote. Quote, the results indicate, in Lepster's opinion, that the Ona specimen, in many respects, shows a primitive, so to speak, australoid type, though, of course, the specimen did not belong to a representative of that race. It is, on the whole, a highly developed type, but one which presents a large number of primitive characters. On the purely morphological grounds of the available material, it does not seem to Lepzeber very probable that unmixed australoid had ever been present in South America. End quote. Bias against Black Africa? Scientific conclusions based on the peopling of America has not changed since 1909, and the mention of the ancient skulls belonging to Negro people from Africa has been scarce. Archaeologists such as Walter Nevis and Dr. Goudon have reported that Africans could have possibly been the first people to come to America, yet no extensive research in this particular field known to the public has been done, despite the mounting evidence. Omission of Negro people from ancient America. Quote, so far as known, the supposed Australian and Malaysian blacks have left no sites that could be attributed to them, No recognizable accumulations, no archaeological remains whatsoever in any part of America. They must have forgotten the boats they came in, and even the sea itself, becoming largely land dwellers. There is no trustworthy tradition about them. The evidence appears at first sight so sufficient and so well-backed that some serious students, though perhaps they have never had the chance to study the American natives firsthand or to any material extent, feel justified in accepting and even fostering the hypothesis, and that whatever cultural or other resemblance may appear to exist between the pre-Columbian Americas and the South Seas must have other explanations than any material accession of the peoples of the later parts of the world to the American populations, end quote. Final analysis. Though there have been several accounts of Black people in America before Columbus from early explorers, and several anthropologists from Europe and America believe that there were Negro or Black people in America before Columbus, Alice Hardilaca dismisses these narratives and states that there isn't enough evidence to prove that Black people were in America before Columbus, and if they were, they made no significant contribution. Moreover, Alice Hardilaca was a racist and committed horrible atrocities against Black people and Native Americans, and the scariest part of all is that for 40 years, he held a high position in the Smithsonian, which to most academics is one of the most well-respected institutions and trustworthy sources of scientific information. When looking at this document, I noticed most anthropologists mention, as they do presently, that the early Negro skulls could have come from Africa, but focuses only on Negroes outside of Africa. When this document was written, there was no evidence outside of the skull shape suggesting where these Negro skulls could have come from. Yet the possibility of Negroes from Africa populating the Americas was conveniently, as they are today, left out of the narrative.
All right. There you have it. The clock is fleeting. Let's roll.
The 15th Amendment to the Constitution of the United States of America, passed by Congress in 1869.
The right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude.
Construction, federal troops occupied Mississippi. Among the laws they enforced was the constitutional amendment guaranteeing a right of all men to vote, and the newly freed slaves did vote. With blacks in the majority in Mississippi, this state sent two black senators and one black congressman to Washington. At least 200 other blacks held public office. They were Republicans, the party of Lincoln.
They were deeply engaged in the legislative process. We had individuals getting elected to office across the state because they understood the value of impact in public policy and being actively engaged. They understood the value of coming from a position of slavery and servitude to being full citizens.
But many white Southerners did not support black equality. Even worse, they took the law into their own hands.
It's murder and terror and violence. Preventing blacks from voting or doing this political work that they have been doing.
By the mid-1870s, Reconstruction was over, and the federal troops were gone.
They pulled out the support for the newly freed people. So the Ku Klux Klan and the white Lioners took over.
There was mass killing and coup d'etats taking place all across the state of Mississippi, reversing a trend that had begun right after the Civil War of full participation of all of Mississippi's citizens.
And in 1890, Mississippi adopted a new constitution, literacy tests and poll taxes, which prevented a large number of blacks from voting, became law.
Mississippi reverted back. It wasn't a system of slavery, but it was a system of segregation. It made it illegal for blacks and whites to marry. It made it illegal for blacks and whites to attend school together. It made it illegal for blacks to vote without passing literacy tests and having grandfather clauses and poll taxes.
For the next 75 years, it was slavery, but by another name, Jim Crow. The 15th Amendment, guaranteeing the right to vote, went unenforced. African Americans in Mississippi were unequaled under the law. For most, life was little or no better than under slavery.
People really did live as if it was the Middle Ages. They were fiefs on the plantations. If they got to go to school, they got to go to school for only a few months a year during the winter time when there was nothing to do. Otherwise, they were just animals for labor on the plantation.
They were living in virtuous slavery then. They didn't have no rights. They had to get up and go to work when they say. Couldn't leave the plantation.
In order to change their status, blacks had to be able to vote. But the government and the Klan enforced the poll taxes and literacy laws enacted in 1890. Blacks attempting to register had to know the state constitution.
They had a old cigar box or something. He had all this section of the constitution. He'd shake it up and tell you to pick a number. Then you had to cite whatever number he pick out, the section of the constitution, exactly word by word.
Most of the time, it was just a farce, and that made it worse when they would pick an impossible question. White people didn't have to go through all of that.
And for most blacks, the poll taxes were outrageously expensive.
That poll tax in some areas of the state could equate a month's pay for them. It could equate 2 weeks' pay. It was a significant amount because African Americans were being exploited for cheap labor. They were not paid much for their labor, so only those who had a little bit more means could even afford to pay a poll tax.
Whites also threatened the livelihoods and lives of blacks who tried to register.
In the times they talk about literally being shot and killed, they talk about how their houses would be bombed. They talk about how they might lose the job that they had. How were they going to feed their families?
But World War II veterans returning to Mississippi after risking their lives for their country discovered that they were not allowed even the basic right of voting. As they began to demand their due, the modern civil rights movement began. Violence increased. Mississippi had more lynchings than any other state.
People were getting killed. You had a resistance built in, the poll taxes, the literacy test. We had less black people voting in 1960 than we had in 1950.
White Mississippians were talking about and saying that black people didn't want to vote.
But not wanting to vote was far from the truth. Veterans such as Medgar Evers and Aaron Henry crusaded for voting rights.
They want to make sure that citizens of this country could cast their vote free of intimidation and vote suppression methods such as poll tax. Those individuals formed the base of the NAACP across the state.
They also became a support network for young students and others. One of them was Bob Moses. A teacher from New York, he came to Mississippi and they began to organize across the state.
So we actually start the project in the southwest corner of the state.
Macomb, where less than 1% of eligible blacks were registered to vote. Statewide, the number was closer to 5%. Macomb is where Hollis Watkins met Bob Moses.
He was working on voter registration, trying to get black people registered to vote so that they could begin to run and occupy political positions. So I told him I definitely would be willing to be a part of that.
A native of the region, Watkins talked with friends, neighbors, and anyone who would listen.
What is it that you have to lose? The white people are killing black people anyway.
for no reason at all. We know that. So, if by chance you end up losing your life, you know, for doing something that need to be done that will benefit your people as a whole, then you ought to be willing to do that, because you don't know whether they are coming to take your life later on today or tomorrow for no reason at all other than you just being black.
Understandably, though, people were reluctant to register.
They looked at that as being something that was against the status quo. It was something that would bring about serious harm, possibly death, to them if they attempted to register to vote.
Still, people understood the need for the ballot.
People want work. They want employment. They want to pull themselves up by their own bootstraps, this kind of thing, and not be knocked down every time you try to make change. Education was the key to employment, to jobs, to security. You had no access to education if you didn't have a vote. So the cycle continued.
By the early 1960s, civil rights protests in Mississippi were gaining momentum and attention. The Freedom Rides had ended in Jackson. James Meredith had entered the University of Mississippi. And in 1963, NAACP Field Secretary Medgar Evers was murdered.
Medgar's assassination really shifted the consciousness of some people in the country and began the path where the action in Mississippi began to take on a national importance.
Nonetheless, black voter registration was still quite low.
By the fall of 1963, we had had a 90% failure rate, and we had probably brought 90 to 100,000 black people to take the test, and only a few thousand ever passed it.
Then it becomes clear to us, well, this road into voter registration has sort of come to an end. It's at that point that we think about running people. We had run people for office, but now we're thinking, let's do that on a bigger scale.
They designed mock elections to teach people how to vote, and they moved to Greenwood.
Greenwood was chosen not because it would be any easier than McComb. If anything, the Delta was going to be much harder, but we might as well send people into the most difficult place of all and use Greenwood as an anchor and build out from there.
We set up our own parallel machinery so people could register to vote if they couldn't register at the courthouse.
Aaron Henry ran for governor. Ed King was the candidate for lieutenant governor.
Bob Moses came to me and said, we want to make this an interracial ticket, and we need to show that black people are willing to vote for a white candidate who supports their same goals.
So candidates of both colors talked about the issues pertinent to the disenfranchised.
Better education, employment and job training for rural workers, black or whites, as the plantations were mechanized. We would set up ballot boxes in churches, in pool halls, in juke joints, and let the people have a real ballot to mark. We knew we wouldn't be elected because we weren't on the real ballot, but the feel was that of a real election.
Then, in November 1963, they held the Freedom Vote.
When we had the Freedom Vote, you know, we had somewhere in the neighborhood of 84,000 people that participated in that, that proved that if this thing is open and fair, black people will definitely register and they will definitely participate on election day through the process of voting.
Outsiders came to help with this Freedom Vote. One of them was Al Lowenstein.
People who run Mississippi today can only do so by force.
They cannot allow a free election in Mississippi because if they did, they wouldn't run Mississippi.
Al brings students from Yale and Stanford down to participate in those elections.
With the white students involved, the violence against blacks decreased drastically. An idea emerged. Bring white students to Mississippi for a summer-long voter registration project. Not everyone thought this was a good idea.
I was opposed to a large number of people coming down from the North for the 1964 summer project. It was my feeling that to bring all of these young people from the North, they would take over and begin to do everything that needed to be done, taking the initiative that we had worked so hard to bring about, taking that away from the local community people. But after a few months, they're going to be gone.
And then there were others who felt that this was very dangerous.
But what I thought was if we did not get American attention, those 30 or 40 local people are going to lose their jobs. One or two are going to be killed in each county. And we're not going to be able to even do the grassroots work. So that was the debate.
The discussion continued until they received a critical phone call. Lewis Allen was a black activist in Ahmed County who had witnessed a racial murder and later talked to the FBI. Now, Lewis Allen had been murdered.
I think that was really the turning point in this, is that brought everybody more together around that you're going to have to do something else because we're dying.
I put my weight behind the idea of the summer project, and we move forward from there.
We hope to send into Mississippi this summer upwards of 1,000 teachers, ministers, lawyers, and students from all around the country.
When we announced that we were going to have this summer project, and Mississippi went bonkers, and they started forming the League of White Racists, whatever they call themselves, right? You got editorials in the national paper, you know, attacking us as wanting to start another civil war.
Because in one sense, as you can say, we were actually in a war. It was really strategic thing, except that one camp was unarmed, except in terms of ideas and commitment, and there was another camp that was armed.
And the organizers began recruiting volunteers.
The initial recruitment was done through the contacts that Al Lowenstein had at both Yale and Stanford, and so that happened in the spring of 1964 across the college campuses. The recruitment, the screening, and the getting of the volunteers to come down.
So we felt that you got the what we call the children of the Constitution, which were the white kids to come in to bring more attention, as people are going to be concerned about their children.
I recruited students at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. This kind of thing. And I was in touch with some college chaplains. So I always felt like, do they really realize what we're asking them to do? But basically we're asking them to come and die with us, because we were going to have a showdown. We were going to bring everything to a head that we could in Freedom Summer.
So these young people believed in democracy. And I think that they were volunteering because they were like true Americans. Mm-hmm. What they were saying is, I'm here to right a wrong that's being done to this country and democracy. And they saw these people suffering, wild people suffering. I mean, just this is a basic right, the right to vote. And I think a lot of people young people didn't understand this.
And through the National Council of Churches, organizers set up training sessions at what was then Western College for Women in Oxford, Ohio.
Very little of it was actually classroom. People sat out on the grass around, you know, in the shade of a tree and sat in a circle and talked. It was both to get to know the volunteers, to get a sense of who they were and what they were about, and let them get a sense of us, to talk about specific programs that were going on in different parts of the state. There was a good deal of role-playing and discussion about what they might face in the state when they came to the state.
A minister from Iowa and summer volunteer, Rams Barber, stayed with a local family in Canton.
They were sticking their necks out, you know. I mean, the people who housed us, the white folks knew who was doing it. The police rode by and knew where you stayed and who was keeping you and all that sort of thing. So it was dangerous for them.
But the main message was just being in Mississippi, being part of a black community.
If you just go and you actually figure out how you can just be a person who is living in this family, in this black community, and getting to know the people that you are living with, because with you comes the country, and the country will see through your eyes, and so all you have to do is be there and survive.
And they meant survive. In the Ohio training sessions, organizers emphasize the risks.
We have to make sure we say to everyone and be very specific and clear, and that is, if you're coming to Mississippi, you must know that you should be prepared to be beaten, to go to jail, and to be killed. And if you're not prepared for all three of those, we suggest that you go back home and do whatever you can to aid and assist the movement from there.
President Johnson has ordered 200 Marines and 8 helicopters to join in the search for 3 civil rights workers missing in Mississippi.
In the first days of the Mississippi Summer Project, 3 volunteers went missing.
The whole state is poised around these people who are coming that they think of as invaders, and here comes a small party, right? An advanced guard, so to speak.
One of the volunteers was Mickey Schwerner. He and his wife Rita had arrived at Meridian in January. James Cheney was a native Mississippian, and Andrew Goodman had been in Mississippi just over 24 hours. The 3 headed to Neshoba County to investigate a church that had been burned and to support the parishioners. America learned much later that all 3 had been murdered by local law enforcement. But first, they searched.
We had checked every jail, every hospital for 4 or 5 counties, and figured they hadn't been in a car wreck or the hospital would, you know, admit to having them. We didn't believe the jailers.
Although the 3 were classified as missing, Moses was certain they were dead. At the Ohio training session, he spoke to the volunteers about to leave for Mississippi.
My concern is that they really understand now in a deeper level what they have gotten themselves into. That you live in a country where law enforcement officers will murder students because they are doing something that they think is contrary, right, to their beliefs about how this country should run itself. My whole point was to make clear to them that those young people were dead and they should not go down unless they were willing to face that.
When the word was announced, to me, I saw a certain degree of disbelief. I saw expressions of sadness. I saw expressions of indecisiveness. And after a song or so was sang, then I saw a collectiveness process begin to take place where people kind of collected themselves and began to say, I'm going on to Mississippi.
The federal government offered a $25,000 reward for information. But FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover was saying,
they've been seen in Brazil and all this stuff here. They're not really missing. This is a ploy on the part of the civil rights workers to get attention, you know. And all the time, they knew where the bodies were.
At Tougaloo College, Ed King was receiving information from two women near the scene of the murders.
They disappeared on Sunday. I was told by Thursday that the bodies were in a new dam under construction.
The search for the missing volunteers continued for 44 days.
They were finding bodies from the time of June when the kids were missing, Chaney and them were missing, to that period of time as they were finding bodies.
It also opened up the reality. This was not an anomaly. This was not an exception. This was the way in which Mississippi operated, and that those black bodies did not have the same value as those two individuals who happened to be from New York.
I will never forget the night of August the 2nd. We were at Mount Olive Baptist Church.
Folk singer Pete Seeger was in the middle of a concert.
I remember someone whispered to him, and before he sung this next song, he said, "I have something to announce to you. They have found the bodies." Then all of a sudden we stood up and we joined hands and we started singing, "We Shall Overcome."
We were determined then, they shall not have died in vain. So instead of intimidating us, it had the opposite effect on us.
And I think the death of Chaney, Goodman, and Schwerner only accelerated the realities of the terror that Mississippians were living in.
My fellow Americans, I am about to sign into law the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
Although Mississippi senators fought against the bill, the state watched as President Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act on July 2nd.
We believe that all men are entitled to the blessings of liberty, yet millions are being deprived of those blessings, not because of their own failures, but because of the color of their skin.
When the Civil Rights Act had been passed, you know, to me it says, finally, at least, the federal government seemed as if it is listening and looking at the atrocities and things that we, as black people, have had to go through and are still going through. And it's going to at least get one of the feet that's on us and our necks. It's going to get it off, where we can breathe, catch some fresh air, and do something that we've had a right to do all of our lives.
But in spite of...
All right, ladies and gentlemen, there you have it. I couldn't run it all, but I did the best I could of cramming it all into the broadcast as much as I could do. And I hope you got something out of this. We're going to convert this over into a video. It'll be up on YouTube. And keep in mind, a lot of what I said tonight on this broadcast is always edited. You will automatically not hear a lot of what I said on this broadcast because of the ability to edit information out. But everything I said tonight was critical mass. It doesn't matter. We're not going to let you be the rightful owners of your land. We're gonna fight you for being who you are, and the fact is your land, and we know doggone well we ain't got no business on it. We know who the rightful owners of it is. We're going to fight you so that we can be here, because not only can we not leave, we are sitting ducks for you. But we can't leave. So here we are. Y'all have a good evening. I've been your host, Tahaka Amane LB, and good night. I mean, I'm sorry, grand evening, because ain't nobody mourning here. Y'all have a nice day.